Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking with Dave Johnson from the Campaign for America's Future about his piece, Did American Workers Get What They Deserved? And you look at this last election cycle and all of the nonsense that's been going on since. And the question is, did we get what we deserved or did we not know? Can you say that the American electorate was ignorant and didn't understand that the right was marching down this path and was being pretty honest about it? All of the Chamber of Commerce money, the GOP hit squad, all of the secret money coming from the Koch brothers and the Olin Foundations and all of these big moneyed interests, escapes, all this big billionaire money coming in to these secret, these very secretive, euphemistically named front groups like Americans for Prosperity and Freedom Works and, you know all the crazy groups with those really, really happy sounding names. So that ought to be interesting. In the second hour, Todd Singer, president of AFSCME Council 13, is going to be here to talk about the convention that they're having. Council 13 is having their convention in Hershey tonight. So they're kicking off tonight. So we'll talk to him about what they're hoping to come away with out of this, where the direction's going to be in the days as we march forward. Because understand, the attacks in Wisconsin, the attacks in Michigan, Ohio, all of that stuff is marching our way. And I'm telling you, I think next week we're in for it ourselves. In the third hour, Sally Greenberg, the National Consumer League Executive Director and co-chair of the Child Labor Coalition, going to be here talking about child labor laws. You know, again, you've got these Republican governors and these legislature across the country saying, you know what, we want to go back and take some of that regulation, that pesky regulation away. So we can have children working in the, you know, have those children going back to work. You know, they're not getting an education anyway. Just put them out in the fields. Or, like in Missouri, put them into a hotel. That's a great idea. But today was Mitchell Day. And to the United Mine Workers of America, to miners across this country, this is a big day. Because this was the day back in the 1800s where, you know what? They got the 8-hour day. You know, we take that for granted. But people fought, bled, and died, struck months at a time to be able to say that, you know what, we're going to have some family time. We're going to be able to have some leisure time. The idea of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for sleep, and 8 hours for what we will was the mantra up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put in the maximum hour rules of 40 hours a week. Now, that didn't mean that you couldn't work over 40 hours a week. What it meant was you got overtime. In other countries, like France, for instance, their maximum hours means maximum hours. That's it. You don't work more than that. So interesting stuff. Today, again, the Mitchell Day, April 1st, and out in Waynesburg, PA, thousands of union coal miners and supporters were out in the southwestern town of Pennsylvania, mobilizing for, you know, what they see as being the war on organized labor. And Pennsylvania AFL-CIO President Rick Bloomingdale told the snowbound crowd at the Greene County Fairgrounds, quote, "There's a bad, bad wind coming out of the west, and it's up to us to stop it at the doors." And, you know, being out on the southwestern part of the state, it is coming across from Ohio. Next week is going to be the week where we start seeing a lot of this craziness come to fruition. A lot of these anti-worker bills are going to be coming up. So it's going to take a lot of folks getting out, having their voices heard, getting a lot of people here to the Capitol and in the streets around the state to, you know, kind of show support for this. You know, I was talking to a guy here this afternoon, and I said, you know, you're not going to see the all-out onslaught that you saw in Ohio and in Wisconsin. You're not going to see that all-out assault because, honestly and truthfully, the members here are pretty strong together. And they've done a pretty good job of talking to their legislators. The families have done a good job of showing that they're a voting bloc. So even some Republicans here are going, well, you know what, we're not going to agree with the insanity. But understand, it's coming. Some of the fringe stuff, some of the things where they're going to be pitting people against each other, we're going to see a bunch of that coming. And we will be here to talk about it, and we'll be here to report on it, because I think it's important that you know what assaults are coming down the road and what they mean. One of the big things that we're going to be hearing is something with the thresholds on the prevailing wage jobs. You know, right now it's at a certain level. They want to raise that higher. And what that means once they raise that cap, they don't have to bid it out anymore. It doesn't have to be something that, you know, they put up for bid. It can just go to someone's brother-in-law, which, you know, if you're related to somebody who's, you know, in charge of a township or a project, that's good for you, but not good for all of us. So it's going to be an interesting week next week, as every week has been since Republicans have taken power. I mean, coming in here every day, there's so much fodder, and there's so much insanity, and there's so much to get upset about, and so much to get riled up and into the streets about. That's why on Monday we're going to have the We Are One rally here in Harrisburg, Capitol Rotunda, Monday, April 4th, 11:30. You know, basically get out, show the governor and his lackeys, you know, that they better not do what some of the crazy people have done. They better stick to our values and our principles. And the reality is, the reason I think Monday is so important is really to kind of flesh out who our friends are. You know, in Wisconsin, you know, I think people were surprised that, and especially some of the labor people I talked to, that the Democrats took such a hard line. And the Democrats, you know, they really put their political future on the line by leaving the state and saying, you know what, we're not going to stand here and be railroaded over. We're going to let this bill be seen. We're going to let people get into it and find out how bad this is, so that maybe you can, you know, diminish some of the really negative effects. We're going to see on Monday and the coming days who our friends are. We already know who the enemies are. We know who the crazy right-wingers are, because they feel emboldened right now to stand out there and say all those things they've been whispering to each other like giddy little schoolgirls in the cloakroom. So they feel emboldened right now. I'm thinking they're in for a big surprise here very soon, but they're emboldened. They're in power. They're the ones who control the agenda. In fact, they control everything. You know, Democrats can go home. There's nothing for them to do here because the Republicans control this state so strongly. So the question is, who are our friends? You know, who are the Democrats who are our friends? Who are the Republicans who are our friends? And, you know, I don't get tied up too much into I'm a working class guy. At the end of the day, I would love to see more working class Republicans. Would love to. The problem is what's happened to the Republican Party over the last 30 years is it has really been co-opted by big business. You have to toe the big business line. You have to toe the corporate line. You have to toe the anti-union line in order to get any campaign funding. And as long as that's the way it is, you're going to continue to get people who are further and further and further and further out on the fringe. And that's what we've got now. We've got the culmination of 30 years of corporations controlling the Republican Party. And, to a large extent, the Democratic Party. There are a lot of Democrats who I go, really? You know, I don't use the Dino name often, but there are some that you go, I don't know that you're really a Democrat. In the way that I see it, with the values that I hold. You know, so at the end of this, what this is going to flesh out for me is who our friends are. Who are my friends? Who are the people that you can turn to in the time that you need? Who are the ones who are going to stand up for the working people of this country? Because as we've seen, especially with the phone call to the Wisconsin governor when he said, when the fake Koch brother said, why don't we send in some troublemakers? And the governor said, well, you know, we thought of that. We thought of that. Do you think he's a friend to working people? I don't think so. And the news outlets, the right wing loves to say, oh, the media is all liberals. I've yet to find a really, truly, strongly supported mainstream liberal media. I haven't seen it. Well, MSNBC, well, I don't know about that. The New York Times, I don't know about that. And you look at this, the fact that Arianna Huffington was just interviewed by the New York Times, and she revealed a bit of news that I think is probably going to surprise a lot of people who read Huffington Post. She says Huffington Post is no longer a lefty site. Now, I got to be honest, I'm never a big Huffington Post fan. I know some of my friends are. I'm not. But it does have a pretty massive audience of Democrats, progressives, people who call themselves liberals. And I guess it shows that there are very few places for progressives and liberals and Democrats to go for progressive voices. So when AOL bought Huffington Post, for me, it was kind of that moment where you go, well, now it's done because it's corporatized and they're going to make sure that it's going to talk to the left, but in a corporate manner. And, you know, now you got Sarah Arianna Huffington running around because she's the bigwig over there. Like, what title did they gave her some title, and the editor in chief of its new Huffington Post Media Group. So Arianna is the editor in chief. Of this new thing. And she's even saying now, well, you know, we're beyond left and right. We're something else. Yeah, you're something else, all right. Something that I can't trust. When AOL pays $315 million for a website, you kind of got to go, they're getting something for it. Now, I understand. And this shocked me when I read it. But evidently Huffington Post has more readers than the New York Times. I'm surprised by that. But to be honest, you know, again, you go back to this, who are your friends? Is Huffington Post going to be one of our friends? I don't know. From this point forward, they're just another one of the corporate controlled media. The corporate controlled for-profit media. How much can they put in their pocket and what stories are going to sell? What bothers me about Huffington Post is they built their model on the very corporate model. How much can we cheat our workers out of? How little can we pay our workers? How much can we take from them? And how titillating can we be? When you see, some of the stories that get the most clicks, they're the ones that aren't really hard nosed. I better not go there, but they may make you. That's a whole nother story. But here again, you know, I look at this and these media outlets that are controlled, bought and paid for, by big corporations like the Koch brothers and like AOL. You got to know what you're getting, folks. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Dave Johnson, Campaign for America's Future. Remember, Monday, April 4th, mark your calendars, 11:30 p.m., Capitol Rotunda, the We Are One rally to show the governor and his lackeys. We're united. We're back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Resistance, maybe even a statewide referendum, will continue in Ohio against a new law that strips away collective bargaining rights for public workers. Jesse Russell reports.
The next step for SB 5 in Ohio could be a citizens' referendum that would block the implementation of the law. If the Buckeye State manages to get the legislation on the ballot, the law cannot go into effect until after the referendum. Opponents of the legislation now have 90 days to collect more than 230,000 signatures in order to get the measure on the ballot for November 2011. The law strips collective bargaining rights for 350,000 public sector employees. Speaking on the floor of the Ohio House Wednesday, Representative Alicia Reese compared the fight over Senate Bill 5 to David versus Goliath.
The nurses, the teachers, the janitors, the custodians, little Davids, the police officers, the firefighters, correctional officers, the bus drivers, the little Davids, the social workers, the sanitation workers.
Reese closed her speech on the floor by saying the little Davids would take the fight to the ballot box.
I will tell you that the little Davids are in this fight to the end. And there will be a time when we take this to the ballot that the government, Goliath, will be challenged.
In Wisconsin, a Dane County judge reaffirmed Thursday that her order against the bill gutting collective bargaining for public workers blocks implementation of the law. Republican Governor Scott Walker's regime has defied the order by going ahead with implementation of the law. But Thursday, State Department of Administration Secretary Mike Hipsch said implementation was suspended based on Judge Marianne Sumi's order. Legal challenges to the anti-union bill by the mayor of Madison, the county executive of Dane County, and by the firefighters and other unions have at least temporarily blocked the bill from actually becoming law. Walker's administration began to implement the law anyway, though, after it was published by the state's Legislative Reference Bureau, which is required to publish laws when they pass the legislature. But even the head of that bureau says that the law doesn't actually go into effect until Wisconsin's Secretary of State publishes the law. The judge has blocked that. Judge Sumi declared on Thursday that this bill gutting collective bargaining in Wisconsin is not in effect. This newscast, made possible by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers, Iron Ship Builders, Blacksmiths, Forgers, and Helpers, and by the AFL-CIO, America's labor movement.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. A recent Gallup poll found nearly half of Americans agree with state employee unions, while only 39% favored the radical right Republican governors in states that are attacking them. An additional 13%, and this is one of those things that just grabs me, 13% had no opinion. The results were split along party lines, with all 65% of the Republicans supported the governors, while 70% of Democrats chose the labor unions. Republican governors in Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana, Maine, and a bunch of other states are working to strip union rights from their citizens and the workers that they control. So I asked my Republican union friends, is this what you voted for? Are these the values of the party that you belong to? Is this what you signed up for? And our friend Dave Johnson over at the Campaign for American Future asked the question, did American workers get what they deserved? We're going to find out. Dave, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Rick?
Did they get what they deserved?
Well, that's the question that I put in this post, because this came from the Holland, Michigan Sentinel. Community columnist Ray Bersma wrote about this. He says American workers got what they deserved. And he's trying to make a case here. He says, remember the Reagan standard? Are you better off than you were a decade ago, two decades, three? Unless you make $380,000 a year, the answer is no, because your standard of living over the last quarter century has actually decreased that much relative. Well, millionaires have increased 30% in their net wealth. He goes on like that for a while. He talks about how the jobs went overseas, especially manufacturing jobs. And politicians you elected did nothing to stop it. And he says people just kept voting and voting for that for tax cuts, which most of us you know, we think we got tax cuts. We didn't. They all went to the millionaires. So Burisma writes about that, but I disagreed. And my post, by the way, is at Our Future, and I hope you can go there and then click through to read his post. But I talked about how many things have gotten worse since Reagan and why a bit, because I linked through to a lot of stuff that has been written at Our Future about that. But here's what I said. I said, I don't blame working people. After all, they're working, so they're busy and stressed and focused on work. They can't be expected to keep up with the little details and facts and nuances, especially when they are attacked daily with a barrage of well-funded and professionally crafted corporate conservative propaganda. And then I talked a little more, and then I listed a bunch of alternative information sites where you can get information now, because one of the biggest things, you know, Rick, I'm a little older. One of the biggest things I've seen change since the time of Reagan was that the news media is very different.
Well, we've seen mass consolidation, and, you know, the end of the fairness doctrine, and I blame Bill Clinton just as much as I blame Ronald Reagan. You look at that telecom bill of 96, which allowed the media to consolidate even further. And right now, radio is under assault even further, because you're looking at number two buying number three. Cumulus is going to get bought out by Citadel.
But you know what? When we had 60 votes in the Senate and a majority in the House and a Democratic president until not long ago, nobody brought the Fairness Doctrine up. You know, under Reagan, the Congress, when Reagan killed the Fairness Doctrine, the Congress passed it, and Reagan vetoed it. Then they did it again, and he vetoed it. Then under Bush, they passed it, he vetoed it. Under Clinton, the House passed it, and the Republicans in the Senate vetoed it. So you would have thought, you know, that finally they had a chance to do something about it, but they never even brought it up. And that's how much things have changed and moved right, you know, in the last few years. So, but I don't blame working people. I don't think working people, you know, are the experts on everything, and they can just go with what they're presented with. You know, people like you and me were scouring the blogs. You know, we're listening to everything, and we're really aware of what's going on. But most people, like I said, they're working people, so they're working. So they're busy.
Yeah.
So I don't blame them, really. You know, I don't blame kids that started smoking. It wasn't the kids' fault. It's not the kids' personal responsibility. They're kids. You know, there's so much of this blame the victim kind of stuff going on. You know, it's your fault if you don't know that you didn't choose the right kind of doctor, all of these things they say. And no, it's not people's fault if they're not getting the right information. And so that's what I was writing about.
I can identify with that to a degree. There's part of me that says, you know, the 51% of the union members in this state that voted for Pat Toomey and Tom Corporate here in the governor's office, and the majority of union members in Ohio that voted for that insaniac there. They did. I have to believe that they did know that the Republicans were going to destroy union jobs. There's part of me that, look, at the end of this, it is as it's been. Since the Civil War, Republicans have been the party of corporate America, or at least since the Roaring Twenties, they've been the party of the big businesses. What makes you think, in fact, this whole election, that whole up until November, was run government like a business?
Hey, I can talk about that a little, because, you know, I was in Pennsylvania for a week before the election in September, and I was watching the ads they were running, and I'll tell you something. Those ads didn't say they were Democrats or Republicans. Some of the Democrats' ads said Democrats, but the Republicans didn't say they were Republicans. But I saw a lot of Republican ads that said that so-and-so, the Democrat, voted to cut $500 billion from Social Security. That's what I saw, and that's a trick, because that's not what happened. But also, and by the way, Republicans took the senior vote for the first time ever this time. Part of what happened was tricking people to think they're not voting. You know, if we can get back to convincing people to look at the party of who they're voting for, that might help a lot. But I suspect that a lot of those union people didn't get it, that they were voting for a Republican, and didn't get it, that they were voting for somebody that was going to come in and kill labor rights, you know?
Well, they may not have got it then, but they're sure getting it now.
Yeah, and they're getting it, too. They're really getting it. Especially, like, in Wisconsin, they're already, you know, even though the judge ordered them not to, they started cutting the paychecks, and they stopped taken out union dues to give the union last week, even though the judge ordered them not to. They said on the news I just heard, labor news you were playing, that the judge is ordering the Secretary of State not to sign it, and it's going back. But, you know, it's just terrible what's happening, you know, and the planned labor agreements and things like that around the country. That how many 17 states already are pulling tricks like this on public employee unions? So,
well, 37 states are going after some sort of labor law reform, type of labor theft. 37 states. And is it, you know, and again, you know, you see, you can't blame the workers. In 37 states, somehow, you've got these, and maybe you're right. Maybe it is this big moneyed, Citizens United caused all this money to flow into these euphemistically named front groups who are out there peddling this fear and smear. Maybe that is it.
Well, there's a lot of trickery out there, and I didn't see ads that said so-and-so's a Republican, and I think that's part of it, but you're right. We've got to get that party identification clear again, because I think it's, and we're seeing it, by the way. When the news just now said the recent poll showed, was it you or was it the news, said that a recent poll showed that, 11 or 15% didn't know?
Yeah, 13%.
A few weeks back, maybe a month ago, it was a much higher number of people didn't know or couldn't answer or just said they didn't know enough about unions to say whether they liked them or not. And that's changing fast. That's a good thing that's coming out of this, is the public's becoming aware of what's going on, and maybe we can get something out of that. But the other side of that is, like I said, they're already not taking union dues out of paychecks to give to the unions. And so what we're going to have in the next election is corporations spending even more than they spent this time, and they spent a lot this time. And then the unions aren't going to have the money anymore. So that's why they're doing it.
That's not the game plan. You're right.
That's the game plan. You know, they say it's to save the pension funds and this and that, but the pension funds aren't what's bankrupting the state. And union people, you know, teachers who make, what, $50,000 a year aren't bankrupting the state. But the ability of the unions to campaign and say, wait a minute, look what they did to you. You know, they're not going to be able to even say that in a lot of these states next time. They're not going to have the money to come back and do that. So that's the game plan, like you said.
But at the end of this, I still have to believe that if you work for a living, if you punch a clock and you go to work and you bust your behind, how can you look to the Republican Party for solace? How can you look to the party of corporate America and say, the party of the CEO and say, yeah, that's my party? How can you identify with that?
Well, look at the trick they're running. Look at the trick. They're saying, look, these people have pensions. You don't have pensions, so you should be against them. I mean, you know, they don't get it that a lot of people are going to figure out, hey, wait a minute, maybe I should be in a union then.
Well, yeah, because I'm the one who's saying, if you don't have a pension, don't be angry at me for having one. Ask me how I got it so you can get it too.
Yeah, exactly. And you can get it too if you're listening out there. You can get it too. They keep saying, oh, we're broke. I'm in California, and we've got this $26 billion budget shortfall this year. And they're saying, oh, we're broke. We have to cut out the teachers and all these, you know, they're even cutting out care for mentally retarded kids, you know, who's going to take care of them, you know? But anyway, there's one guy in California. There's more than one guy, but there's one guy in California who could pay the entire deficit himself and have $13 billion left over. So I don't know what you mean by we when you say we're broke, but we as a people aren't broke. That's not the problem. Now, I'm not saying we should take that guy's money, you know, $26 billion, but this one guy's got so much money that he'd have $13 billion left over. And there's a lot of people like that in California. So the problem is that they cut those taxes at the top. They cut them, and they said they were cutting them in order to bankrupt the government so that the government would stop being able to do these things for people. They said that. Reagan said that he was cutting their allowance, and they said they were going to cause this debt crisis. And when Bush was first in office, he said, when they told him, look, we're already going straight to a deficit, Bush said, and this is a quote, and you can Google this, he said it was incredibly positive news, he said, because this will put the government in a straitjacket, he said. And here we are now. You know, I mean, that was the plan. Like you said, it was the game plan. Here we are. And then they're blaming the workers for it. You know, it's always they follow this long plan, and then when people start noticing, they're always pointing a finger and blaming, you know, finding some scapegoat to blame it on. I mean, it's obvious to a lot of people right now, you know, what's going on. around the country now, that the money's all going, you know, all these things, that all the money just gets siphoned up to the top, and then they blame you for not having any money.
Yeah, I think Grover Norquist is a guy who put it probably best when he said this.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
Which is basically what they're doing.
He doesn't want to abolish it. He wants to drown it.
Yeah. Well, you know, but when you look at the fact that the top 400 wage takers in this country control half of the nation's wealth, 400 people control half the nation's wealth, and the top 1% controls nearly 64% of the nation's wealth, I think we got a distribution problem.
Yeah, that's 400 people. The Forbes 400, just 400 people versus half of a country of 350 million people.
Yep.
And that you know, when I wrote that post that brought that out, I don't know if you knew that, but Michael Moore used my post when he brought that out in his speech in Madison. I had a post that had pictures, 9 pictures of the to illustrate the wealth gap. One of the things I put in there was I ride my bicycle through this nice neighborhood that's, you know, not too far from where I live, and I passed. There was this mansion for sale, you know, for only, what, $8 million, I think. And then I said, you know, this is where I ride my bike, but it's not the neighborhood I live in, because the neighborhood I live in has a soup kitchen that serves 200 or 300 people a day. And, you know, that's the discrepancy there. This one house and then 200 or 300 people going to a soup kitchen because of the concentration of wealth that goes to people who live in a house like that. And then 200 or 300 people have to go to a soup kitchen just to eat. So, I think that 400 people kind of says it all. 400 people have more wealth than 175 million Americans combined.
But, you know, you listen to our T-Twits and you're talking about redistribution of wealth.
Yeah,
well,
that's right.
Well,
that's
what do you think happened?
It's supposed to work. That's the only way it can work, in fact. That's why we have rules against monopolies, too, because the system can work with the markets. It can help, you know, it can help be an efficient way to allocate consumer goods and things like that. But if you don't put controls on it and you don't make sure, you know, that somebody's not grabbing everything, it's not going to work, because the nature of the system is that it all concentrates in a few hands. That we learned that in the late 1800s when one guy controlled the railroads, and because he controlled the railroads, he said, if you want to ship your oil, you got to pay me this amount of it. And he said, if you're going to ship so-and-so, if you want to ship your grain, because he had control over that. And pretty soon he had control over this huge number of companies. And a few people had they were called the robber barons, and they pretty much had everything. So they made it illegal. And then under Reagan, they stopped enforcing these antitrust laws. And under Bush, they sure stopped enforcing them. And so we're seeing it again. And it just, the system can work, but it can't work if you don't put some rules on it. And that includes redistributing the wealth through taxes, so that we use that tax money to educate people, build up the infrastructure. And it's not just, they say, we talked about this before too, it's not anti-business to say this, because the other thing that happens is the other businesses can't make it. See, you got me shouting, Rick.
I didn't hear you shouting. I thought you were very, very reasonable and very articulate.
Well, you can't see me, but I'm frothing.
Okay. The piece is, Did American Workers Get What They Deserve? OurFuture.org is the website where you can find that. Or you can just go to RickSmithShow.com and click on Dave Johnson's name. Dave, always great to talk to you. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks for having me on, Rick. Glad to come back anytime.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, you do my business hat. I'm on to 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, teaching America for the better.
I've recently joined hundreds of Texans in a Day of the Fallen protest, leading our march to the state capitol were people bearing 138 black coffins. This was not a war protest, not in the sense of a shooting war, but it was a protest about the senseless casualties in America's relentless class war. The caskets symbolized the 138 Texas construction workers who died on the job in 2009. This is a national issue, but my state, hailed by our governor as business-friendly, is number one in the nation in the business of killing and maiming those who dig our trenches, erect our condos, wire our office buildings, roof our houses, and otherwise put themselves on the line to construct and maintain a modern city. Another construction worker dies every 2.5 days in Texas. Needlessly. Here and elsewhere around the country, corporate chieftains and political leaders simply avert their eyes from this routine mayhem. You never find a CEO or governor at the funerals. And since they will themselves not to see the problems, they do nothing to fix them. In Texas, builders and contractors are even required to provide basic safety training and equipment, carry workers' compensation insurance, or allow rest breaks. Working 8 to 12 hours or more a day in 100-degree heat is inherently dangerous, and with no precautions or breaks, injuries and deaths are inevitable. Bear in mind that these corporations are profitable. They certainly can afford to give workers a couple of 10-minute breaks in an 8-hour shift. This is Jim Hightower saying, imagine the urgent cry for reform if construction company CEOs were being killed at the rate of 1 every 2.5 days. It's time to put some ethics back in the work ethic. To help, contact the National Organization of Injured Workers at www.noiw.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
What you need to do, you need to do the Third Street Shuffle. You need to shuffle your behind up to the steps of the Capitol, into the rotunda on Monday, April 4th at 11:30 a.m. I may have said p.m. before. I got my head at night. But 11:30 a.m. in the Capitol Rotunda. Come on out. We're going to be there on Monday for the We Are One rally. We're going to show the governor and his lackeys that we are united against his really just insane budget. The thought that you're going to cut $1 billion from education, you're going to cut higher education by 56%, to me just shows, well, a lack of vision, a lack of a thought of tomorrow, or just a complete lack of caring. So come on out with us Monday, April 4th, 11 a.m., Capitol Rotunda. We will be there. Hope to see you as well. Today is the 1st of April. And with that comes some funny stories. Our friends at Penn Jive write, Harrisburg, Mid-State, National Public Radio and Television Station, WITF, announced it would be changing its call letters to create a whole new image in the wake of NPR's national president announcing her resignation last month. The station plans to drop the I in WITF, renaming the station WTF in order to appeal to the younger demographic. A budget analyst at the station said they expected the change would result in a more efficient operation. He says, we've cut our costs by 25%. Sorry, got to go. The governor's calling me with a job offer. The change also came in conjunction with the station's 40th birthday, which they also celebrated today. Kathleen Pavelko, president and CEO of WITF, soon to be WTF, said the transition should be a smooth one, particularly since young people already use the phrase WTF so often. It's like they saw it coming. Aha, our friends at Penn Jive. For those of us out of the area, the big newspaper here is the Patriot News, and they have a Penn Live place where they put the stories. This is Penn Jive. Interesting stuff, funny stuff. Anyway, I don't know if you saw this article on the other day by Paul Krugman, and I thought it really kind of laid it out in a nice way, and I like the way Krugman lays things out. It's titled The Mellon Doctrine. You know, the big billionaire from the robber baron from the past, the Mellon Banks, the guy who Richard Mellon Scaife got his money from when the Mellons and the Scaifes came together. Carnegie Mellon, same one. He was Herbert Hoover's Treasury Secretary His name was Andrew Mellon. And Hoover claims that the advice that Mellon gave him was, quote, liquidate labor, liquidate stocks, liquidate the farmers, liquidate real estate. Liquidate everything. Just sell it all off. Get rid of it. And as we know, America plunged into a Great Depression, thanks to probably that advice and then some more. But Krugman says it's clear now that the Mellon-style liquidationism is now the official doctrine of the GOP. Just 2 weeks ago, the Republicans released a Congressional Joint Economic Committee report titled Spend Less, Owe Less, Grow the Economy. Basically, what they argued is that if they slash government spending enough and employment in the face of the Depression would actually increase. Basically, if they slash government enough, they cut enough government jobs, they push enough high-skilled, educated workers out into the private labor market, that it would create jobs by lowering the cost of labor. Now, that's taking a couple of things, a couple of assumptions. One of those assumptions being that government workers make more than they do in the private sector. That's not the case, and Krugman doesn't go into this, but it's not the case that public sector workers make all that much than the public sector workers, or than the private sector workers. In fact, most of the reports that I've seen show public sector workers trailing. So this idea that if we kick them out into the job market, it's going to lower wages, and that's going to create jobs. So I guess the thought process here is bust up what's left of the unions, kick those teachers to the curb, and the more educated workers will take those moderately decent paying jobs, and increase the labor supply, thus pushing down the wages. And according to the Republicans, lower wages is good for everyone. I think it's only good for big corporations and for the shareholders and for profits. I don't know that it's good for workers. And I go back to when Clinton signed that welfare bill back in 96. The local McDonald's was paying $10 an hour in Allentown. As soon as that bill went into effect and they shoved all those workers into the workforce, with nowhere else to go, that McDonald's job went down to minimum wage. What you did is you had a massive influx of labor into a particular sector, which sent it all down. And, he goes on to talk about the logic that the Republicans are trying to use. This idea that lower wages creates jobs. It's ridiculous. Because the only thing that creates jobs is demand. No business, no matter how little you pay in wages, is going to hire someone unless they can sell their product. So if they have, you can produce. If nobody's buying, nothing happens. You have to lay people off no matter what the wage is. And here's where Krugman makes a good argument. He says the fallacy of their composition is this. Since workers at an individual company may be able to save their jobs by taking a pay cut, you might think that we can increase overall employment by cutting everyone's wages. So what he's saying is when General Motors went to their workforce and said, you know what, we're cutting your wages down to $14 an hour, and it's basically saved the company. What the Republicans are saying is, well, GM's a pretty big company. We can do that across the entire economy. Everybody will take cuts, and it'll save all these companies. Here's the problem. If you cut everybody's wages simultaneously, all you've really done is created a situation where now everybody who works is poorer. Their debt problems don't go away. Their bills don't go away. Food prices don't go down. All you have is a bunch more people who are in poverty, which, of course, is the plan. And, you look at the fact that, the Republicans suggest that, you cut public spending, that's somehow going to increase private investment. Somehow, if we cut what we do here, like taking money from education, somehow a for-profit company is going to come in and fill that void. It's ridiculous. And it hasn't happened. Understand what the public sector does. The public sector takes over things that the private sector doesn't want. services that they feel that they can't profit from. You know, like taking care of children, you know, like education, you know, like taking care of granny in her old age, when she has no more money left and she's indigent. You know, that kind of stuff. Social good kind of stuff. But the Republicans don't see it that way. What they see is they've got this idea that, you know, somehow if we cut enough, you know, there'll be profit to be made. There'll be jobs out there. There's not. This idea, this thought process has been tried and it's been failed. They've gone, and Krugman uses the phrase expansionary austerity. A doctrine of expansionary austerity, which means that the middle class takes bigger pay cuts. The middle class loses more tax deductions, which is why you're hearing them talking about taking away mortgage deductions, and why you're hearing about taxing health care benefits, and why you're hearing all of this stuff aimed at raising the Social Security age, all of that stuff that we in the middle, that we benefit from. Yet we've yet to hear anyone in the Republican Party say, you know what, there's a billionaire class out there. 400 people own half of the wealth of this country. 400 have half of the wealth of this country. Maybe we should ask them for something. I'm not saying take out all of it. I'm thinking half, some of it, to help out. Times are tough. You know, the difference between, the difference between having caviar 7 days a week and maybe having, filet mignon one day. Do you think the wealthy could get away with that? As opposed to people going from the store brand macaroni and cheese to cat food. At some point, this expansionary austerity where the working people of the country just have to tighten their belts. You know, we run our economy like we run your kitchen table. And the reality is the globe has figured this out. This spread the pain isn't working. And you look at what happens in Egypt, you look what's happening in Tunisia, you look what's happening around the globe where people are starving and they're rising up. And we better watch out here. Because if the Republicans get what they want and what they keep telling us they want, that kind of stuff can happen right here. It can happen right here. But understand, the Republicans are fully committed to this doctrine of expansionary austerity, which means you and I are going to suffer more. And what's I think is going to happen, and this is what Krugman writes. He believes the Republicans think that we have to destroy employment in order to save it. So we got to destroy jobs before they can come back as lower paying jobs. That's the key in this. He finishes it up by saying, and Democrats are offering little pushback. The White House in particular has effectively surrendered in the war of ideas. It no longer even tries to make the case against sharp spending cuts in the face of high unemployment. So that's the state of policy debate in the world's greatest nation. One party has embraced 80-year-old economic fallacies, while the other has lost the will to fight. And American families will pay the price. And I agree with them. A great article. It's called The Mellon Doctrine. Take a look at it. We're going to take a quick break. Remember, April 4th, 11:30 a.m., Capitol Rotunda. Come on out and say hello to the governor with us. We're going to take a break right back after this.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him Jim at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania
happy! Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, you know, it's going to fall very soon because they're still talking about going after Social Security. This is their grand wet dream. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts on this? They really want Social Security. They really want to give it to Wall Street and put it in the hands of those criminals who are going to steal half of that just like they did our 401ks. And now they're pushing this idea, this Bowles-Simpson Deficit Commission. They're insane recommendations. And I saw this piece over at Politico, and he had written a letter saying, hey, this is why I am not signing on to the Simpson-Bowles Deficit Commission. He was asked by a group of former members of the Council of Economic Advisers, and he said, no, look, I'm not going to sign it because I don't agree with it. And he writes, quote, I believe the Bowles-Simpson recommendations represent to large an extent a set of unprincipled political compromises that would lead to a weaker America with slower growth and a more divided society. Now, understand what he's saying. Look, at the end of this, this is political. All the people on this thing are political. And if you go through and you look who the folks were on this, the vast majority of them were senators or congressmen. And the people who weren't, like David Cote, the chairman and CEO of Honeywell, a union buster, somebody who moves jobs out of the country, he's sitting on the deficit commission, a multi-million dollar CEO. You go, how'd he get there? Well, he got there because he's a multi-million dollar CEO. So what he's, you know, he goes and he looks at the realities of the commission's recommendations. And the number one thing he comes up with, he says, the ballooning of the deficit since the crisis struck has understandably moved deficit reduction to the center of debate. So look, you know, since the Bush collapse happened, we've spent a lot of money to help prop the economy up, to help stave off some of the mass suffering that could have happened. The fact that you could have people in the streets, starving in the streets. He said, you know, I understand that. He says, but the best way to reduce the deficit is to put America back to work. It's that simple. And yesterday I talked about back in 1933, Franklin Roosevelt signed the Civil Conservation Corps bill. The CCC putting people to work. Some 6.5 million people went back to work. And you know, one of the amazing facts I learned when I read about this, in the first 3 months, the average weight gain of that 6.5 million people was 11 pounds. They were feeding people. People had money in their pockets to buy food and to make a better tomorrow. I mean, to me, that's a remarkable statement. Stiglitz says, overwhelmingly, the deficit increase has been caused by the enormous shortfall between the economy's potential and actual output. Even as growth has resumed, the output gap, reflecting in high unemployment, has persisted. The Bowles-Simpson recommendations, if adopted, would constitute a near-suicide pact. Growth would slow, tax revenues would diminish, and the improvement of the deficit would be minimal. So even if we do all the things that Erskine Bowles and that a-hole Simpson would want to do to us, it's not going to help. It's not going to make our situation any better. We can shoot retirement, Social Security up to 75 years old. If we don't have the jobs, if we don't have people paying into the system, it's not going to matter. And that's where I agree with Tricky Ricky Santorum. I don't agree with his premise that, you know, we need all the babies that he's pandering for. I do think we need people paying into the system. Those 14.5 million unemployed, if we put them back to work, you know, going back to, you know, the Santorum, what would we be doing with another 40 million people in this country? Would we have 44.5 million people unemployed? What would we do with them? So for me, I go to what Stiglitz says. He says years of underinvestment in the public sector, years of underinvestment in infrastructure, education, and technology means that there's an ample high return opportunity. So instead of cutting billions of dollars in education, we should be investing in education. Instead of slashing tax rates, and not investing in infrastructure, we should be building rail lines. We should be building highways. We should be building broadband technology instead of places like North Carolina saying, oh, you communities, you can't upgrade your internet. You've got to buy it from those two companies who have their lines there. We need to protect their profits. Instead of saying that, say, we're going to invest in the future of this country. The problem is corporate America has taken over too much in this country, and we're just too blind to see it. And what he's talking, what Stiglitz is talking about is exactly what I've been saying for the last 6 years. We need a progressive tax system. What we need is we need to shift the burden from the low and middle income people in this country back to the people who have incomes that are going up. It's amazing to me. For the last 30 years, the working class of this country has seen their wages decline and their tax burdens go up. And yes, I'm with you, T-Twits. I am taxed enough already. But you can't say no new taxes, you can't say no taxes, when there are people who are getting away with paying less as a percentage of your income than you are. So he says, Americans, the only group in the country that has prospered in the last decade, would have double benefits. The shift would stimulate the economy in the short run and reduce the growing divide in the country in the long run. So if we tax the very wealthy, it's going to help stimulate the economy in the short run, and it's going to shrink the divide. It's going to shrink that gulf between me and Warren Buffett. It's going to shrink the difference between the guy who gets his hands dirty and punches the clock and the CEO who is basically robbing him blind. A quarter of all income goes to the upper 1%. And the middle class, well, you're worse off, much worse off. There's so much more I got to get this. But, you know, again, I got to take a break here in a second. We're giving multi-millions of dollars away to the very top of this, in this country. And yet what we've seen, what we have done, has not helped us a bit. So I'm asking my Republican friends, stop and think about this for a minute. The only way we get this country back on track is to tax those who have a little bit more. Because there's, as I pointed out last night, we can slash all of the things Republicans are screaming about. We can slash that welfare program to the poor people. We can slash all that money that goes to foreign countries. We can slash NPR and the arts and all of that other stuff. And you know what you end up with? You end up with about a 2% savings. About a 2% savings. We need revenue. We don't have a spending problem. We have a revenue problem. And I'm going to want to pick up Stiglitz in a little bit. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Todd Singer, president of AFSCME, Council 13, back after this. I guess that's why.
making the blue blood see red.
The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Three Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Resistance, maybe even a statewide referendum, will continue in Ohio against a new law that strips away collective bargaining rights for public workers. Jesse Russell reports.
The next step for SB 5 in Ohio could be a citizens' referendum that would block the implementation of the law. If the Buckeye State manages to get the legislation on the ballot, the law cannot go into effect until after the referendum. Opponents of the legislation now have 90 days to collect more than 230,000 signatures in order to get the measure on the ballot for November 2011. The law strips collective bargaining rights for 350,000 public sector employees. Speaking on the floor of the Ohio House Wednesday, Representative Alicia Reese compared the fight over Senate Bill 5 to David versus Goliath.
The nurses, the teachers, the janitors, the custodians, little Davids, the police officers, the firefighters, correctional officers, the bus drivers, the little Davids, the social workers, the sanitation workers.
Reese closed her speech on the floor by saying the little Davids would take the fight to the ballot box.
I will tell you that the little Davids are in this fight to the end. And there will be a time when we take this to the ballot that the government, Goliath, will be challenged.
In Wisconsin, a Dane County judge reaffirmed Thursday that her order against the bill gutting collective bargaining for public workers blocks implementation of the law. Republican Governor Scott Walker's regime has defied the order by going ahead with implementation of the law. But Thursday, State Department of Administration Secretary Mike Hipsch said implementation was suspended based on Judge Marianne Sumi's order. Legal challenges to the anti-union bill by the mayor of Madison, the county executive of Dane County, and by the firefighters and other unions have at least temporarily blocked the bill from actually becoming law. Walker's administration began to implement the law anyway, though, after it was published by the state's Legislative Reference Bureau, which is required to publish laws when they pass the legislature. But even the head of that bureau says that the law doesn't actually go into effect until Wisconsin's Secretary of State publishes the law. The judge has blocked that. Judge Sumi declared on Thursday that this bill gutting collective bargaining in Wisconsin is not in effect. This newscast, made possible by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers, Iron Ship Builders, Blacksmiths, Forgers, and Helpers, and by the AFL-CIO, America's Labor Movement.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Away from the city, the noise and crowds, freeway ride. If they slashed off London, they cut all their hours by Washington decree. So here I stand with a long line of cars, everyone yelling at me. When did I become a problem? How did the world become online? The president says, we're tightening the belt. The only one that's tightening is mine.
Well, you know, that's the game plan. They want to squeeze the working class of this country, especially, you know, right now the public sector workers are the flavor of the month. And what's going on, you have to understand, we're all of us in the working class, we're all in the shark tank. Eventually they're going to come for us. Right now it's just the public sector workers, but we're all on the menu, folks. And that's why on Monday, April 4th, 11:30 a.m., Capitol Rotunda here in Harrisburg, I hope folks will come out and have their voices heard. Tell the governor, you got to do something about these massive budget cuts that you're talking about. Oh, I don't know, maybe close the Delaware loophole. Maybe go after taxing some of the drillers who are raping our land and then sucking the resource out from under our feet. Maybe that's a good start. Anyway, today being April 1st, our friends over at Penn Jive, not Penn Live, Penn Jive, have written the piece. Mimi Schmirt, a 28-year employee of the Department of Health, said she was absolutely stunned to learn this week that her mid-level administrative position in state government was not going to lead to fabulous riches. She said, I am so disappointed. You know, after a colleague sent a recent blog post from The Economist that explained most people who work for state government don't do it for the money, I just couldn't take it. She said, just the other day, I popped in on our Department of Human Resources director, who was going on and on about the wine tasting tour in Paris he took with his wife last year, Ms. Schmertz said. She said, I thought, all right, that's what I'm talking about. Then a colleague pointed out that she's married to a big shot in the natural gas industry. Mrs. Schmertz's husband, Dwight Schmert, a longtime low-level planner for PennDOT, said his wife was taking the news very hard. He said, I don't know how she got her hands on The Economist. Usually she just reads People or Us. But she was pretty upset when it came home from the hairdresser. Mrs. Schmertz said, the worst part is now she can't be as smug about her fat taxpayer-funded paychecks when she sees her private sector employed friends like Betty, the stocker at the Giant Foods. She goes on to say, I don't know, I don't even know anymore if I make as much money as she does. It'll be hard to be Lord. Maybe I can take her place. Well, you know, good for Mrs. Schmert. Talking about public employees, let's talk to our good friend Todd Singer. He's the president of AFSCME Council 13. They're having their convention starting tonight, running through the weekend. Todd, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you, Rick. I appreciate you reaching out to us.
You know, our friends over at Penn Jive have this piece, State Workers Stunned. Stunned to learn that the government jobs, not the pathway to riches.
We are on the front burner, you know, and it just seemed that this happened like overnight, you would think. I mean, you know, years ago, you would have never thought that this day would be here. But, yeah, here it comes, and it's alive and well.
Well, on one hand, I look at what's going on here in Pennsylvania, and it's not – I don't think it's be as crazy as Ohio or Wisconsin or Michigan basically, because you guys are a little bit stronger. You're a little bit better organized, I think, than maybe the other states are, and have done a much better job of educating members to talk to their members of Congress and or members of the state legislature. And maybe the assaults won't be as great, but I do believe they are coming.
Yeah, and you know, point well taken. And, you know, you couldn't have said it any better. You know, one thing I got to admit is, you know, and I don't mean to give kudos to our council because, you know, I'm the state president, but when it's deserved, it's deserved. And one thing that I love about our executive director, David Stillman, is that he invests so much time back into our members. He invests so much time into training, into educating. And let me tell you, the payoff is what's showing now. We are one of the states that, you know, they have absolutely committed to saying, you know, and admitted that, you know, no, we don't want to go down that road like they are out in Wisconsin. You know, we are better prepared. We have done our homework. There's other states that are now looking at us, Pennsylvania, saying that, you know, gosh, you know, we want to come up there and hang with you for a little bit and see how you guys have been able to be successful with this.
Now, the point being also, and I think what most people need to understand is the Republicans do control every here, and there are going to be some massive attacks. But again, I don't think it's going to be as crazy as we're seeing in places like Ohio, Wisconsin, or even Maine, where the guy who beats up children and steals their candy is stripping the murals off the wall that has anything to do with labor on it.
Oh, can you believe that? And then and now I found out. In fact, I just heard where. Who was that? And that was Governor Paul LePage, I believe.
Yes.
And, I believe they went from 7.65 up to almost 9.65 increase in their pension payments up there. And worse yet is, you know, he somehow exempted himself.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
But everybody else has to pay.
Yep.
And right there you go. I mean, it couldn't be any better for the Republicans to establish what their agendas are. You know, is to harm the working class, and, you know, they want to get out of paying taxes and everything that they can.
Well, let me ask you this. As president of Council 13, I would have to assume that as these attacks have unfolded across the country, that your membership has had to come together and unite a little bit, maybe become a little stronger, more of a cohesive unit. Are you seeing that kind of pulling together, even the people who may not have been strong supporters in the past?
Yes, absolutely we are. And I'll tell you, if anybody deserves credit, it's got to be our young members. And there again, you know, we instituted a program. It's called our Next Wave. And the next wave is simply geared towards our young members. And, you know, let me tell you, without them being involved as they are, you know, they are truly the ones who are beating on the drums. You know, they keep it going. They're texting. They're blogging. They are the ones who are simply making the unions cool again.
Yep.
You know, they're putting us out there, and, you know, it's starting to show light here again.
You know, I'm trying to find labor leaders who are going to thank Scott Walker, because to be honest, you know, for the most part, you know, people never heard the word collective bargaining. People never talked about union rights. People never talked about having a voice on the job. By the attacks that have come out of Wisconsin, how are you going to use this? And I guess this is a how-to question. How are you going to use this springboard to now get out and reach out to people and begin to take this momentum and turn it into an actual movement across our state and across the country?
Well, you know, again, you know, I think one of the things are that I got to say is it's really depending, again, on our young members as well. But, you know, it's hard to do. It's just not that simple. But if right now, if they are tuned into us, now is the time that they are. And, you know, it's a good time to be tuned in, because we are clearly trying to get, you know, the word out there to be prepared, you know, to be up to date. We need everybody who may not have had quite that interest before to have an interest. You know, the CLEAR Coalition is phenomenal. And, you know, and which I'm sure you're aware of the CLEAR Coalition. And without them, I think they've been a huge asset to try, you know, to getting the word out there.
And they're having, on May 3rd, I believe they're having a rally here in Harrisburg.
Right.
More details to come as we get closer to the May 3rd deadline. Just like on Monday the 4th, here, 11:30 a.m. Capitol Rotunda, the We Are One rally, 11:30 a.m. there, to tell the governor and his lackeys that we are united against that turd of a budget of his.
Yeah, and let me say, I'm looking very forward to that rally. You know, and everybody should be there, please. Yeah, I couldn't agree anymore. If there's a time that we need everybody, it is this Monday, April 4th. And, you know, that is your Capitol building. You know, that's not the governor's Capitol building. It's our Capitol building. And, you know, we have the right to go in there and express what our concerns are and to tell our elected leaders that, you know, this is not a road that we want to go down. There is no benefit from this.
Now, I understand some contracts are up this summer. These are going to be tough, contentious negotiations. The governor of this state has not said he's going to go down the road of trying to strip anyone's rights away, but he did say something that disturbed me, which is that if it doesn't work in his view for the taxpayers, that it's not going to work. And I kind of thought, I took that as kind of a line in the sand where if you don't do what I say, well, maybe I will come after you. Are you prepared for that kind of a situation?
Well, you know, we're going to be prepared as much as we are. And, you know, until, you know, that time comes, I'm sure we're going to deal with it. You know, we're trying to be optimistic and, you know, hopefully come up with, you know, some type of resolution. I mean, the rumors have been flying all through the Commonwealth already that we've already agreed to a two-year contract, you know, that we agreed to, you know, no increases in wages and everything. But, you know, there's nothing. We have not agreed to one thing as of today, of this minute. But, you know, when that time comes, my gosh, if it would go there, you know, we're going to deal with it.
Right.
Absolutely.
And those are the things you deal with at the table. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Todd Singer, president of AFSCME Council 13. You know, I look at all of this, and I'm so tired of hearing people just throwing away the high ground. And what I'm hoping doesn't happen with you guys, and because this idea of, well, we're willing to take cuts, we're willing to contribute more, we're willing to do all of these things to appease the governor, without saying we're willing to do those things if we ask others to sacrifice as well, meaning closing the Delaware loophole, meaning taxing the drillers, which, you know, we're already paying the tax, we're just not reaping the benefit from. To me, you've got to use that negotiation to make it this really shared sacrifice instead of this vision of shared sacrifice.
Yeah, and that is absolutely the truth. Any common sense person, elected official, you know, whether, and it's not even if you're a Democrat or a Republican or an independent, but anybody who would come into office, I would clearly think that they would absolutely immediately close that Delaware loophole. You know, tax the Marcellus Shale. You know, everything that is very obvious to do. We would clearly be in a much better situation where we could all sit down and really, you know, try to hammer out something that is to the best of you know, everybody's ability. And, you know, but for them to take a backseat on the very obvious tax, you know, where, you know, that doesn't affect our pocketbooks and our wallets. Yeah, I just still to this day cannot understand why they would take that position, other than to be clearly that there's some backdoor deal that, you know, I don't know, that maybe we're not aware of, or
I think we're perfectly aware of it, Todd. It's the, it's the fact that our governor, the person who occupies the governor's mansion, took some twisted, bizarre, gimmicky anti-tax pledge and took over $1 million from the drilling industry.
Yeah, he sure did.
That's pretty
clear.
Last question I've got for you. I'll let you get back to the party there at the convention or you know the meetings, whatever's going on. This weekend is you know your convention about bringing your members together. What are you hoping comes out of this weekend? What do you think's gonna, what benefits you think are gonna happen?
You know, what I'm really hoping comes out of this is that come Monday, when these active members return back into the workforce, that they are going to discuss amongst coworkers of, you know, just really where things are as of today. You know, Executive Director Philman and myself are going to make it very clear, you know, where AFSCME stands, you know, with issues. You know, we're going to simply educate them. We need them to be aware, and we want them to understand exactly what is at stake. You know, we're having some very good speakers coming in. Liz Shula is coming in to speak to us. Our International Secretary Treasurer, Lee Saunders, is coming up here to speak. And they're very well aware of, you know, what's at stake here in Pennsylvania alone.
Well, I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. We're going to bring the show there tomorrow and talk to your members. And because, you know, we love you guys there at AFSCME 13. Keep up the good work. And, Todd, always great to talk to you.
You too. Thank you very much.
Todd Singer, our good friend over at AFSCME Council 13. He's the president there. We're going to take a quick break right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I recently joined hundreds of Texans in a Day of the Fallen protest, leading our march to the state capitol were people bearing 138 black coffins. This was not a war protest, not in the sense of a shooting war, but it was a protest about the senseless casualties in America's relentless class war. The caskets symbolize the 138 Texas construction workers who died on the job in 2009. This is a national issue, but my state, hailed by our governor as business-friendly, is number one in the nation in the business of killing and maiming those who dig our trenches, erect our condos, wire our office buildings, roof our houses, and otherwise put themselves on the line to construct and maintain a modern city. Another construction worker dies every 2.5 days in Texas. Needlessly. Here and elsewhere around the country, corporate chieftains and political leaders simply avert their eyes from this routine mayhem. You never find a CEO or governor at the funerals. And since they will themselves not to see the problems, they do nothing to fix them. In Texas, builders and contractors are not even required to provide basic safety training and equipment, carry workers' compensation insurance, or allow rest breaks. Working 8 to 12 hours or more a day in 100-degree heat is inherently dangerous, and with no precautions or breaks, injuries and deaths are inevitable. Bear in mind that these corporations are profitable. They certainly can afford to give workers a couple of 10-minute breaks in an 8-hour shift. This is Jim Hightower saying, imagine the urgent cry for reform if construction company CEOs were being killed at the rate of one every 2.5 days. It's time to put some ethics back in the work ethic. To help, contact the National Organization of Injured Workers at www.noiw.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Well, you know, pick up the phone. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, again, if you're a conservative, you disagree with me, I would love to hear your rationale. This whole Simpson-Bowles recommendation thing that I was talking about earlier, if you're in favor of it, I would love to hear your rationale about raising the Social Security age. I would love to hear your rationale for the expansionary austerity that Krugman talked about and how that's going to help us get us back into prosperity. I'm personally a fan of what Stiglitz has to say. Get people back to work. That's what has to happen. Much like Franklin Roosevelt did. You started the Civilian Conservation Corps, got people back to work. That, my friends, that's how we turn things around. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Ike on line one. How are we doing tonight, Ike?
The fascists are coming. The fascists are coming.
They're not coming. They're already here, Ike. I just call them something. They're just corporatists in my title. But you're right.
They're corporate fascists.
There you go.
That's what they are. They want it all for themselves, brother, you know?
But here's the thing. We're letting them get it.
That's the real truth of the whole thing. You know, people out there need to realize something. Labor's only going to ask for what they want for so long before they're going to stand up and take it. You know? And that's where we're at.
Yeah, which is
these
why...
They're in our face. You know, they're making, you know, it's not like they're hiding from us. They're right out there in our face. They've already told us, I mean, they're being absolutely real about who they are, what they want, and what they're going to do. They're going to come after our kids. They're going to come after every social service and every safety net service. And they're going to cut. And meanwhile, an audit that was released in the, you know, New York Times on D4, stated that the GAO said an internal audit of the Pentagon found $70 billion worth of waste. You know, Republicans aren't going to cut that.
Nope.
They're not going to, you know, I mean, my God, you know, this is war. This is absolute war. There's no two ways about it. I talked to my sister tonight, and God help her, she's a teacher down in Florida.
Oh, jeez.
And that scumbag, Mr. Scott, here's the deal. You know, this is something else. You know, I talked to her about it, and I know what's going on down there, and I know who he is. He's a scumbag that ought to be in jail to start with, should have never been elected, which brings me back again to the point that I don't think we've got a secure voting system in this country. I think ever since Diebold, Sequoia, and the rest of these computer hack bastards came in and took over our voting system, well, I don't think we've had a decent straight vote since, in my opinion. I really don't. I think they can manipulate that damn voting machine any which way they want to go.
Yeah, I'm with you.
But here's the deal. For the people out there, I don't know who's hearing me, but I'm telling you, all right? If you can't recall these people out of office, which she can't do down there, you have to impeach them. Okay? They have no recall mechanism. If you don't have a way to recall these public officials, you need to get up off your butts and start circulating petitions to get a recall ability, put on a ballot, and get it done so you can start recalling these clowns. Any state that, you know, people live in, it blows me away. And maybe you can pull it up if you got a whiz-bang computer there. I've been meaning to try to do it. But I'd like to know how many states there are where you can't recall public officials. And I still say that's one of the real, that's the other part of the real problem with our political system. If you look at the other systems like Australia or England or Israel or a lot of other, you know, civilized countries, they've got a recall mechanism built into their system to where if you start screwing around, we jerk your butt out of office. And we need something like that. If we need to build in a little bit more of a parliamentary system to combine with our system, you know, we need that. We definitely need that because I've always been one. Let me ask you something, and here's a good example. Okay, I was a military man, all right? I held my hand up, and I swore to uphold and protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. Well, guess what? If I violated my oath, they could throw my ass in the brig.
Yep.
Now, why in the hell can't we do that with politicians? Why can't we do that with the Supreme Court? These two scumbags, Alito and that other guy, Thomas, who go there and stick their nose up the Koch brothers' butt, and then they go and rule for Citizens United, and then they turn around, and this last thing that I heard, where a guy was on death row, 1 month away from being prosecuted or executed, and it comes out that the prosecutor, Harry Connick Sr., Harry Connick's dad, had the information to release the guy, and they never did. It was prosecuted, you know, and he took it all the way to the Supreme Court to try to get compensated for 18 years in prison. The Supreme Court said, no, the hell with you. The prosecutors can do any damn thing they want. This is fascism, man. That's another good sign of fascism. When they can lock you away, like they do to those people in Gitmo, whether you're a citizen or not, on their say-so, when they can wiretap you, when they can go into your computer with no warrant, when they can do the kind of crap that they've been doing since Bush came into office.
And the Patriot Act.
This is fascism. They trashed our Constitution, brother. Yeah, you got to keep it under glass because it smells like crap. These people are wiping their butt with your Constitution.
And what you got, you've got people running around out there saying, I believe in the Constitution and never read it.
Yeah, you know, not only that, but you got people sitting on the Foreign Affairs Committee, you know, that thinks that, well, you know, we went into Libya. What's next? We're going to go into Africa? Yeah. I mean, my God, these people are,
He's in our listening area.
Well, he's a, you know what he is.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's just another one, you know, and by the way, one other thing. Since when is it that the Tea Party can stick 300, I can't say that word. When they stick 300 people at a rally in front of Bachman and Pence and these other people, 300 people at most at a rally, and we're supposed to pay attention to them like they're some kind of political force.
Yep. I'm right there with you. To me, the Tea Party is nothing but a media construct. But, you know, here again, it comes down to ownership. It comes down to media consolidation, and they're coming after the internet next. They're going to be able to control the content that comes out on the internet by the speed you're going to be able to get there. I'm not in favor of that, but you know what? It's going to take us taking to the streets, I think, man.
And I got a good example for you. Anytime you run into those idiots, when they start that crap about, well, you know, in my household, if I don't have enough money, I cut my spending. Well, you know what? You know how you deal with those people? You tell them straight up, say, look, pal, yeah, okay, fine. You don't have enough money coming in to your household, so you got to cut back. I understand that. But do you cut off your lights and your water and your, you know, do you not buy any food? Do you not, you know, I mean, that's not the way to go. The first thing that you do is you try to get a second job. You try to raise your income.
That's it.
Okay? Yeah, you cut back some. But you don't go cutting off the water and the power to your damn house. You know,
I'm serious, man.
I'm telling you, listen, if they go any further and if this stuff really gets any worse, I'm really worried. And I'm not worried about it getting worked out, but I'm worried about the safety of these public officials. I really am.
Well,
you know, somehow or another, they seem to have forgotten about the 60s. And somehow or another, they think they can just beat the living hell out of the poor man and back him in a corner. And we all know, you back somebody in the corner and put their shoulders up against the wall, it's the same as poking a dog with a stick down to the south down here. Eventually, he's going to come out from underneath the porch, and he's going to chew your ass up.
Yep. I agree.
All right, brother. Well, you know, listen, man, it's killing me, Rick.
I know.
And I'll tell you what, I'm begging the unions, do everything you can do. Get your dues money out. Get your war chest out. Get on the airwaves. Spread it all across this country. And by the way, I want to remind them, this is an international union. And by God, we ought to have support coming in here from Australia and from all over the world, Germany, et cetera. Get your cohorts in these other countries. If we don't have enough money in our war chest, let's get the money.
Absolutely. Ike, I appreciate the call, brother.
Thank you, brother.
You know, and going back to Ike's question about the recalls, there are 19 recall states. Of course, Pennsylvania is not one of them. But there are 19, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. So 19 of them: Alaska, Arizona, California, Colorado, Georgia, Idaho, Illinois, Kansas, Louisiana, Michigan, Minnesota, Montana, Nevada, surprisingly, New Jersey, North Dakota, Oregon, Rhode Island, Washington, and, of course, Wisconsin. When I come back, I want to pick this Stiglitz article up on the other side of the break. I want to finish this up because I think it's important. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Our workers' comp system is a confusing maze of rules, delays, and loopholes, where workers struggle to collect what they are owed. Bills don't get paid, and families struggle to put food on the table after a serious work injury. What happens when you're injured on the job in Pennsylvania? Most people think you just apply for workers' comp, and you'll get paid for lost time, and your medical bills will be covered. Sadly, in Pennsylvania, that is not the case. The good news is, it doesn't have to be that way. Hi, I'm Ron Calhoun, and I'm a Central Pennsylvania workers' compensation attorney. It's my job to make sure injured workers receive the benefits they deserve. In the last 20 years, I have helped hundreds of Pennsylvania workers and their families after they've suffered from a work injury. If you've been injured on the job, I'd like the chance to show you how I might be able to do the same for you. Why not find out what you're rightfully owed? Call me at 717-695-4722. You have nothing to lose and much to gain. Call me at 695-4722.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. It'd be great to hear from you. You know, and going back to this, this piece by Stiglitz, who is a Nobel Prize winning economist. He's no slouch. He's also a former chief economist at the World Bank. So he's got this whole idea of globalization. He's got this whole idea of what's going on in the neoliberal world. One of the few people that I thought should have absolutely been on Obama's economic team. A guy, I think, who gets it on so many levels. And I got to be honest, I was so disappointed when Obama did not put him on that team. He stuck with mostly Bush people, which was surprising to me. Probably because of the TARP money and how that whole thing was set up. I guess you could make the argument that that's the reason that Obama kept the Geithners and the that whole clan, the Paulsons and all them. But I thought this guy should have been one of the people on the team, at least advising him. Because I think he's got it, he's hit it straight on the numbers, with his rationale of why he didn't sign on to the Bowles-Simpson Deficit Commission recommendations, which basically is just spread the pain among the poor and the working class, among the middle class, everybody making probably 70 grand a year and less. Those are the people you harm the most. Because there's more of them. So if we could take some away from all of them, so much better. Because our top 1% of the folks, you know, we shouldn't have to ask them for anything. And I think, again, he was spot on. We got to put people back to work. That's the end of the game. And his belief that signing on to the Bowles-Simpson report would be a near suicide pact, I absolutely agree with, because it would slow growth, and it would diminish tax revenue, and it would make the recovery almost impossible. Because if you're not bringing anything in, you can't invest in things. And maybe that's where, you know, when Grover Norquist said, I want to drag government into the bathtub and drown it. Maybe that's what he meant, starve the beast, which means cut off tax revenue. Keep cutting taxes, and have this constant mantra to where working class people go, you know, all I care about is cutting taxes. I don't care about nothing else. Even though you realize that it doesn't matter to you. And the people over at Tax Notes had a really great graph. They looked at two areas. Clarksdale, Mississippi, a very, very poor area, and Beverly Hills, California. Now, Beverly Hills, California, the average income for the 20,000 people who live in Beverly Hills is about $280,000. You know, right about that, about 280 grand. The people in Clarksdale, Mississippi, have an income of somewhere around 15 grand. Okay? So now you got these people who you know, they've 280 grand, about 15 grand. A mortgage tax deduction for people in Clarksdale, Mississippi, averages out to be about 45 bucks a year. Someone in Beverly Hills, it averages out to be about 1900 bucks per person per year. Who's getting the benefit? I mean, all of a sudden you're seeing that you're making $280,000. You're pocketing more tax dollars. It's costing us in the tax system much more to feed the very top. So when Stiglitz says, you know, it's a near suicide pact. And if we don't have this money, we can't invest in infrastructure. We can't invest in education. We can't invest in technology. And all of those things are what we've been talking about. And he says, look, there's opportunity here. There's opportunity for some reward. And he says, how do we get there? Quite blatantly, we tax the top. That's the reality. He said, just make the tax system a little bit fairer and more efficient at the top. Eliminate the big corporate handouts, eliminate the welfare, all that hidden stuff in the tax system that the lobbyists lobby for, and all the money goes into, ooh, get me this special loophole that'll just help our company. Do away with that. Do away with all of those little bizarre loopholes that protect the speculators and the bankers. Make it an even playing field. You know, I hear often people say, well, we need medical malpractice tort reform. You know, Rick, we need tort reform because there's so many people out there cheating the system. Because that woman who burnt her you-know-what with that hot coffee, she ruined the whole system. And all anybody ever remembers is that she had in court a very big reward, because after all, she did have third degree burns down there. What people don't understand is as it went through the process, as it moved through the court system, she ended up with like $25,000 at the end of it. The award from the jury was like $10 million, which popped people's eyes out. But at the end, the settlement stage was about $25,000 to pay for the skin graft that she had and then pay the lawyers. So who wins in all this? The lawyers win really big. So I'm saying, you know, if you want to do away with tort reform, you want tort reform, you want that, you want to cap my ability to recover damages, then I want the insurance company to only be able to charge me premiums on the claims that they pay. That's it. Not on their speculation, not on their betting on Wall Street, just on what they pay out. I'll bet you you won't get many insurance companies to take that bet. But here's the thing. Stitz writes, the Bowles-Simpson Commission is correct in pointing to the middle-class tax expenditures, which encourage excessive spending on health care and housing. But eliminating these provisions should not be part of the package of deficit reduction. If it were eliminated, the hard-pressed middle class should be protected by corresponding reductions in taxes. And at the end of this, you know, we should have health care for people that we don't have to worry about that high tax break. He says that the Bowles-Simpson Commission has one correct conclusion. At the core of the country's long run of deficits and debt problems are the soaring health care costs. And he looks at Europe. He says, look, if the U.S. health care costs were comparable to those in the European countries, which provide better health care for more citizens at a lower cost, our long-term deficit problems would be completely under control. But what we're talking about doing and what the Bowles-Simpson Commission wants to do is they're going to harm the poor and the aged, and they're going to face rationing. Understand that. Because they're not going to be able to pay for health care services. And he goes out and he says, look, there's some low-lying fruit. There's about $4 trillion that could easily be found. The Cold War. We are still spending tens of billions of dollars on weapons that don't work against the enemies that don't exist anymore. So we don't have the Cold War enemies. Why are we still investing in that kind of thing? And I agree. He says the health care reform bill did eliminate the $1 trillion giveaway to drug companies a little bit. It did very little to do that. What we need to do is we need to negotiate for prices. So the health care bill didn't change Bush's drug bill, didn't change Billy Towson's big pharma bill. Maybe we need to go and negotiate those prices, bring down the cost of health care, and bring down the cost of prescription drugs. He says eliminate corporate welfare, get rid of the hidden tax system, get rid of all of the stuff that that corporate America has had in their pocket for so long. And at the end of it, put people back to work. So at the end of this, it's really simple. Put people back to work. Invest in infrastructure. Invest in building broadband technology and rail and solar and wind farms. Invest in that stuff. Then you tax the top, the wealthy, where the majority of the income is. Go where the money is. And, you know, I'm not talking about taxing them out of existence, but you know what? Times are tough. We should be asking for some sacrifice from them as well. And I'm sorry, in the next segment when we talk about the CEO pay that just came out, some of the numbers, your eyes are going to pop out of your head. Your ears are going to bleed when you hear the amount of obscene wealth being taken by one person at a corporation. It's just absolutely obscene. Also, he says we need to negotiate drugs. We need to get the healthcare system in order, and we need to get people back to work. Because that's the key to all this. And I say it's trade. I say it's our trade policy. I've been saying that for years. If we had sane, rational trade policies that encouraged U.S. businesses to stay here, we wouldn't have the problems we're having now. What's happened is we've given incentive to leave. Whenever they take their plant overseas, there are tax cuts that help them. Does that make any sense to you? Because it doesn't make any sense to me. And having an American company go to China and bring their product back here tariff-free doesn't make any sense to me. you know, that washer and dryer that I may have bought that was built in Clyde, Ohio 10 years ago is now being made in China. It's the same product. It's the same name. It's the same price. What changed? What changed is where it's made, the labor costs, and the profit margin. So the workers suffer. The consumers don't benefit any way, any shape or form. But the profiteers, those at the very top, the CEOs, the investor class, those, my friends, those are the people who get the rewards. And I'm saying, simply put, we should have trade policies that benefit the working class again, provide jobs here. Simple stuff. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Executive Director of CAIU on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated, professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Every time I see these numbers, that rings on fire, I'll tell you that. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Pick up the phone, give us a call. CEO pay, according to the USA Today, soars while workers' pay stalls. They say CEOs didn't cry poor for very long. The heads of the nation's top companies got the biggest raises in recent memory last year after taking a hiatus during the recession. They say at a time when most employees can barely remember their last substantial raise, median CEO pay jumped 27%. That's right, 27% raise. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says workers in the private sector, meanwhile, saw their compensation grow just 2% in the last 12 months, ending December of 2010. 2 years of scaling back amid tough economic times, they write, proved temporary, as three-quarters of the CEOs got raises in 2010, and in many cases, the raises were substantial. You look at the guy who is the number one hog at the trough, if you will. His name, and again, you look at this and you go, really? Really, $84.5 million? His name is Felipe Demun. He is the CEO of Viacom. $84.5 million. He got a 149% increase over 2009. The number two guy, who was number one last year, Ray Irani, from Occidental Petroleum. He took just a meager $76.1 million. And if you remember, you know, our friend William Weldon, the guy from Johnson & Johnson who saw their stock go down and saw massive recalls and the government stepping in to make sure quality control was all right, he got $29 million, nearly $29 million last year. Also collecting $21 million in stock options. So good for him. Good for him, even though his shareholders had a negative return. And good for him. You know, because we need smart people to run our companies into the ground. Now, understand, the median pay for CEOs in 2010 was about $9 million. So basically, they're back to party time levels. You know, they're back to pre-Bush recession party time levels. They got their massive payouts. In fact, they're even better off than they were before the recession, because what's happened now is they've put those workers in line, and they've gotten some massive givebacks. Most of my friends have had stagnant wages, or have been giving some pretty substantial concessions back. So you look at the fact that 27% jump from 2009 to 2010, the largest increase in recent history. And I love their rationale for it. It's pretty funny. Their rationale is that these massive increases in CEO pay are simply a distortion. It's, you know, it's distorted because, you know, during the recession, CEOs took a big hit. You know, they went from 9 million down to just 7.1 million. And that's a really big hit when you're talking about extra cheese on your hamburger. So when their wages snap back, well, then, you know, that looks like a lot, but it's not really. Don't worry about that. 27% number, don't worry about that. It's not a lot. It's a lot, folks. It's an awful lot of money. Paul Hodgson of Governance Metrics is quoted as saying, given the years of pay decreasing, there's a certain amount of catch-up to getting back to where it was in 2007. And I said, well, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with CEOs going back and catching up. But what about their workforce? What about the people who actually create that wealth? Nothing? Anything for them? No, I guess not. Anyway, they got big bonuses, of course. The CEO average, the median CEO bonus in 2010 was $2.2 million, up 47% from the $1.5 million in 2009. So good for them. They also got a bunch more value of their stock because they got a whole bunch of stock while it was down. So, you know, times are tough for you and me, but not the CEO friends. And remember, you know, there's no money to hire people. You know, it's just tough times right now. Tough times. Times are tough. Companies are doing more with less, but where are we seeing the profits going? To the very top. I found a story at Landline, which I thought my trucker friends would be interested in. Chris Morsich writes, last fall, a Montana trucking company owner admitted that he took retirement funds that he had deducted from his employees and didn't bother to contribute it into their IRA. Didn't bother to contribute into the IRA plan. This week, the trucking company owner found out what he would be serving in jail, because he was found guilty, obviously. Guess what? No time whatsoever in jail. Now, if you were to get caught stealing the amount of money that they're talking about, and it's a lot of money, you know, what do you think would have happened? Do you think you'd have gone to jail? Anyway, the story goes on. In December, Michael Paul Molitor pleaded guilty to embezzlement from an employee benefit fund. Beginning in 2004, Molitor reduced employee salaries when employees elected to hold a percentage of their pay for an IRA. Molitor and his brother Donald owned the Montana-based MS Molitor Trucking, and is now involuntarily dissolved because they went broke. And basically what they were doing, and this is, you know, pretty much the end of it, they were taking money from all of their employees every week. The employees thought they were contributing to their 401k or their IRA or whatever it is, and they were just pocketing it, paying their credit card bills, paying their relatives, you know, paying everybody except the workers. So now these workers, they're working along, and they think, hey, you know, we're okay. We're doing all right. We're paying our bills. We're putting a little money aside, putting a little money in our IRA because we're being, you know, good, responsible workers. only to find out that it's not there. So they were ordered, he's ordered to pay the money back. He's broke. It's not going to happen. And they lost any money that they would have gained in interest. So basically it's screw you workers and Mr. Owner of the company, well, you're protected. Don't worry about it. Amazing, amazing stuff to me. Anyway, Monday, April 4th, I want to get to this again, 11:30 a.m. here in Harrisburg at the Capitol Rotunda. We hope everybody will come out for the We Are One rally to show the unity of the community, to show the governor and his lackeys that we are united against this awful, awful budget and against a whole bunch of the attacks that are coming against workers' rights, against the insane school voucher bill, you know, the voucher tax bill that's coming down the pike, you know, all of this insanity. At some point, I'm kind of hoping that we wake up and say, you know what, we better stop things. And what we're seeing is we are seeing people coming together. I point to the story in Politico today, talking about how the firefighters and the policemen have basically been lackeys for the Republicans for years. And now you're seeing that movement away from the Republicans because turns out those cops and those firemen, they like collective bargaining. They like to have a voice on the job. They like to say, you know, this is a dangerous job. We'd like to have some say in our conditions, especially firemen, because I would think firemen would be the ones who'd go, hey, wait a minute. We don't have the right protective gear when that fire breaks out that you want us to go running into. We would like to have a say in how that gets purchased. And now what you're seeing, especially with the attacks in Wisconsin and Ohio, that these firemen, who have been, and most of my people I've known who've been firemen, are big, big Republicans. Why? Because they make a good living. And they see that money coming in. They don't want to pay tax, but they're going, uh-oh, I've really screwed up here. Because not only, they don't just want to tax me, they want to take all my money away. Which is coming, folks. So for my firemen friends, understand. Even though Walker tried to carve out the police and the fire departments, he was still coming for you. And one of the things that I've been saying for the longest time, he wants to take that collective bargaining right away. He wants to take that seat at the table away. See, what most people don't understand is when you look at collective bargaining, that's two people sitting across the table. It's a group of workers and the employer sitting across the table from each other on equal grounds. And boy, they hate that. And saying, okay, what do you want? All right, this is what I want in exchange for that. And you basically negotiate a contract. Nobody has a gun to anybody's head. Nobody's forcing anybody to do anything. But the Republicans want to take that away because they do want to put a gun to your head. They do want to force the conditions. They do want to put you on the menu. And as I've been saying, if you don't have a seat at the table, chances are you're on the menu. And they are coming for you, which is why I think Monday is so important that everyone, cops, firemen, street cleaners, garbage men, plumbers, pipe fitters, whatever, people who swing hammers, drive trucks, wipe snot out of children's noses, I don't care. Bring yourself to the Capitol on April 4th, 11:30 a.m. Here at the Rotunda, because we're going to be there, and I hope that you'll be there too. I think it's that important. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Sally Greenberg of the National Consumer League. She's their executive director. She's also the co-chair of the Child Labor Coalition. And we've been talking about some time now the fact that there have been a bunch of states around the country who are looking at changing their child labor laws. Missouri has probably one of the crazier bills out there that pretty much removes any restrictions whatsoever. Pretty much saying that, you know, 14, 15-year-old kids, they don't have to bother to get a work certificate. They can just work anywhere they want. Children, kids under 16, if you work in any capacity in a motel, hotel, whatever, and if there's sleeping accommodations there, you can work as much as you want. That's what I want. I want a 16-year-old girl, a 15-year-old girl, a 14-year-old girl having her own sleeping quarters with a bunch of people walking around. Yeah, I don't think so. Maybe it's just the father of me. Maybe it's the fact that I got two daughters, and I don't think I'd put them in that position. But our friends in the Republican Party, they don't seem to have any problem with it. So when we come back, we'll talk with Sally Greenberg about that. Your call is 1-888-520-RICK. Remember, check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, right there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Resistance, maybe even a statewide referendum, will continue in Ohio against a new law that strips away collective bargaining rights for public workers. Jesse Russell reports.
The next step for SB 5 in Ohio could be a citizens' referendum that would block the implementation of the law. If the Buckeye State manages to get the legislation on the ballot, the law cannot go into effect until after the referendum. Opponents of the legislation now have 90 days to collect more than 230,000 signatures in order to get the measure on the ballot for November 2011. The law strips collective bargaining rights for 350,000 public sector employees. Speaking on the floor of the Ohio House Wednesday, Representative Alicia Reese compared the fight over Senate Bill 5 to David versus Goliath.
The nurses, the teachers, the janitors, the custodians, little Davids, the police officers, the firefighters, correctional officers, the bus drivers, the little Davids, the social workers, the sanitation workers.
Reese closed her speech on the floor by saying the little Davids would take the fight to the ballot box.
I will tell you that the little Davids are in this fight to the end. And there will be a time when we take this to the ballot that the government, Goliath, will be challenged.
In Wisconsin, a Dane County judge reaffirmed Thursday that her order against the bill gutting collective bargaining for public workers blocks implementation of the law. Republican Governor Scott Walker's regime has defied the order by going ahead with implementation of the law. But Thursday, State Department of Administration Secretary Mike Hipsch said implementation was suspended based on Judge Marianne Sumi's order. Legal challenges to the anti-union bill by the mayor of Madison, the county executive of Dane County, and by the firefighters and other unions have at least temporarily blocked the bill from actually becoming law. Walker's administration began to implement the law anyway, though, after it was published by the state's Legislative Reference Bureau, which is required to publish laws when they pass the legislature. But even the head of that bureau says that the law doesn't actually go into effect until Wisconsin's Secretary of State publishes the law. The judge has blocked that. Judge Sumi declared on Thursday that this bill gutting collective bargaining in Wisconsin is not in effect. This newscast, made possible by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers, Iron Ship Builders, Blacksmiths, Forgers, and Helpers, and by the AFL-CIO, America's labor movement.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, if I were to say that there were states across this country who are going after really laws that have been on the books for, you know, 70, 80 years protecting children in the workforce. You'd think I was talking, I was making a joke with it being April 1st, being April Fool's Day. But the sad reality is, as we've been talking about in the program for some time, there are a couple of states that have got some really, really bizarre ideas on kids in the workforce. And again, you know, it goes back to this whole idea of we need government to run like a business. We need to be more business friendly and thus cheaper labor, more exploitable labor. That's the ticket. That's the way we go. I don't think so. And it is April 1st, and this isn't a joke. I've asked Sally Greenberg. She's the executive director of the National Consumers League, also co-chair of the Child Labor Coalition. Sally, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You know, I'm looking at these bills, especially the one in Missouri and Maine, that are basically declaring open season on younger workers.
Yeah, that's right. And our history, the National Consumers League, was really founded in 1899 to eradicate child labor in the United States. So what we're seeing now is a dialing back of decades and decades of efforts to make sure that kids were out of the workplace and back in school. And if kids are going to work, I mean, we have no problem with kids working, you know, a certain number of hours a week, a small, reasonable amount of time. We prefer them not to work during the school year, but, you know, kids want to earn some money, and there's nothing wrong with putting in 15 hours a week or 16 hours a week. 20 is what the researchers tell us is the absolute most that kids, you know, and their teens should be working during the school year. It's a different story in the summer, of course, and working can be a good experience, but this idea that kids should be working 25, 30, 32 hours a week, almost full time when they're trying to go to school, when they're trying to get an education, when they've got after school activities. We all know teenagers need a lot of sleep. But two states, and you know, our concern is that this is a slippery slope. Two states, Missouri and Maine, seem to think that, hey, those child labor laws, they're old fashioned. Let's bring kids in and have them, earn less than the minimum wage in the case of, in Missouri's case, they want to cut the minimum wage down. Other states are talking about, and so they bring, you know, workers and teenagers in working less than the minimum wage and as a sort of quote unquote internship. Well, you know what that means? That means adult workers are going to get pushed out of jobs so that you can bring young people in and you can pay them less. But the point of, the concern that we have is what's going on in both Maine and Missouri a real retrenchment of protections that we fought really hard for young workers.
You were just so suspicious. I mean, they have the absolute best intentions for these children. Didn't you know these businesses will take them in and treat them right as they've done in the past? I mean, we've got such a good history with child labor after all that, you know, going back to those days might not be a bad thing.
Well, that's, you know, the
mentality. Being facetious, of course.
Yeah, of course you are. Yeah, and it is April Fool's Day, so, you know, they apparently think that we're all fools, that we think that this is going to be a positive thing for young people. But, in fact, you know, if a kid, in some of the states, they're looking for kids to be working till 11 o'clock at night, and these are 16, 17-year-olds, which means, okay, it isn't as though the kid is going to say, you know, I want to work till 11. No, the kid has a job, and, hey, kid, you're going to be working till 11. Well, that's awful late. Well, if you want the job, we need you here till 11. That's too darn late for a kid who's 16 or 17 in school to be working on a school night. And, you know, not only that, but a lot of these kids that are driving, they got to drive themselves home. It's a very dangerous situation to have kids that age on the road, exhausted. One out of four kids, according to a recent study, is falling asleep in school as it is. We don't want to add to their workload, add to their anxiety, and add to sort of the misery factor for young people who the best thing that can happen to them is for them to stay in school, get an education, get a good night's sleep. And, you know, I don't know if for the rest of the parents of teenagers, but I got a 15-year-old kid, and his day is packed.
Yep.
I can't even imagine him spending when we're talking about 32 hours a week or even 24 hours a week, that's 6 days a week, 4 hours a day. I don't know where you would fit that in. So that's the wrong direction. And if I may just say one last thing, in the state of Missouri, they're talking about getting rid of all the inspectors for kids who the child labor inspectors and the minimum wage inspectors. They're gonna zero out the budget for any inspectors.
Nice.
Which to us is like, okay, if you and I take a car and we're driving down the street and they say, you know what, there's stoplights there, but we don't have anybody who's going to enforce those stoplights. So, you know, do whatever you will. You should stop at the light, but if you go through them, there's nobody who's going to stop you from doing it. That's essentially what we're saying. We're giving the green light to anybody and everybody in the employer camp to violate minimum wage laws and violate child labor laws.
Well, I mean, that's, but understand that, and I don't know if you're into the political thing or not, but that's the Republican mantra. Corporate America will police themselves, and of course they'll always do the right thing, much like they did on Wall Street here in 2008.
Right. Well, right. And self-regulation, somehow, falls down on the job. Somehow, some way, they figure out a way to say, you know, this is what's good for America. We're gonna privatize. I just heard Governor Kasich talking about privatizing the schools, privatizing the prisons, privatizing law enforcement, privatizing everything because, you know, the market rules. Well, it doesn't work that way. Like you said, you know, if we're talking about Wall Street, didn't work there. If we're talking about a number of private prisons that end up completely falling down on the job, being miserable failures. It's not that the private sector can't do good jobs with certain things, but there's things that we cannot leave to those who are in it for profit motive alone.
I don't care what you've got. You leave a jar of cookies in a kindergarten class, I guarantee you there's nothing left. If you leave regulations alone and you don't have anybody enforcing them, as you pointed out earlier, I don't care how benevolent the corporation, they are going to break those rules every single time when they know nobody's watching. And in this case, doing away with the wage inspectors, I can almost guarantee, without having done any real research, I can almost guarantee that those kids had wages stolen from them, much like the people we were talking about in the last
segment. Yeah, and we see that all the time. You know, we run the Child Labor Coalition, and one of our major advocacy campaigns is to try to get kids who are child farm worker kids out of the fields and into schools. And there is rampant wage theft. Those kids are supposed to be earning minimum wage. They're out, you know, hours and hours and hours every day. Many of them breaking you know, local laws. Although there's an exemption in the Fair Labor Standards Act, always has been for agriculture, because the agribusinesses, even back in 1938, were able to get themselves exempted. We're trying to close that gap, and we see a lot of kids not getting paid for the time they're putting in, getting paid, you know, peanuts. And wage theft is rampant across certain industries, and that's another area of focus for both the National Consumers League and the Child Labor Coalition.
So let me ask you this: in looking at this, and the state rules are one thing, but are these kids still covered by the federal laws? Because there are some federal laws prohibiting child labor.
There are some federal minimum laws that protect some of these kids. The states are allowed to be more protective, but they will have some basic protections. But you know, the state laws have really come to the rescue because the federal law really provides a bare minimum of set of protections. So it's really been up to states to provide an extra layer of protection to kids, and they can only go, you know, they can't go below what the federal law protects, but state laws are extremely important, and state inspectors are the ones that go around and enforce the laws. And if you take away the budget for inspectors, you're going to have rampant wage minimum wage violations. They've already, in fact, the state of Missouri has data that says that there have been up to $700,000 in fines. I'm sure that's just a tip of the iceberg for violators of the state minimum wage law. Employers who violate that law, and something like 400,000 fines for employers who violate the child labor law.
See, that's why
it's happening out there.
That's why we got to get rid of it.
Exactly.
See, you just caught it.
You
just figured it out. You figured out why it's going to happen, because we need to be more business friendly.
Right. Well, you know, and it's sad because, you know, everybody has a right certainly to make a living, and we don't want to be business unfriendly. On the other hand, businesses are driven. They are driven to make a profit, and unbridled capitalism in a society like ours is going to cause a lot of companies to do things that they shouldn't be doing, wouldn't be doing if there was adequate regulation, if there were rules in place. And if those rules and regulations are not enforced, the profit motive is going to be, God. It's going to rule all, and there won't be any way to hold these employers and companies to the laws that, that they should be following. So we're, you know, we're very, very concerned that we're rolling back the clock and that the founders of my organization are rolling over in their grave because they worked so hard for so many years to make the case that kids need the kinds of protections that that we have in place now, and we're slowly seeing those eroded, and we've forgotten, you know, the days when kids were in mills or in mines or in factories, were dying early deaths, were getting injured and killed on the job. We don't want to return to those days.
And no, so I don't want to return to those days.
Wake up call for us.
I don't want to return to those days, but I think some of our friends on the right do, especially when you look at the fact that here in the state of Pennsylvania, we're talking about a billion-dollar cut to K through 12 education, 56% cut to higher education, and they want
It's heartbreaking. It's really heartbreaking. And, you know, everything is being, you know, we also see all sorts of tax cuts for wealthy business people. There is so much money in this country. Our wealth has tripled in the last several decades and quadrupled. Did you know that the top 400, I heard this statistic recently, I'm going to have to sign off in a little while, but we heard, I heard the statistic that the 400 most wealthy Americans have the same net worth as 50%, the lower 50% of all
the entire
rest
nation.
Of America.
Yep. That's where we get the money from.
The money, the wealth, the unbridled economic bounty that this very small slice of America has been able to enjoy at the expense of everyone else. And it's really our money that they're enjoying.
Yep.
It really should have been spread around, but they've you know, this group has... This elite group of 400 and then some have managed to work it out so that all the riches have gone into the pockets of a few at the expense of the rest of us. And it's really, you know, what we're seeing now is really a sad spectacle. And that's why we, you know, issued a statement. And that's why we're so concerned about the direction that we're going in this country. And we really have to get back to a balance.
I agree with you. Sally Greenberg, National Consumers League Executive Director. I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it was really a pleasure.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Yep. NCLnet.org is the website. You can get there from our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. Take a break. Right back after this.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in their new world. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitive child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Hughley Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more strict
stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Auga! That's my favorite part of that whole song. They go, Auga! I wish they'd get to that. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Again, from our friends at the Pen Jive blog. It is the first, so we're going to have a little bit of some type of humor. Jane Familia of the Pen Jive blog writes, in a breathtaking expansion of the school voucher concept, Senator Jeff Pakola has introduced legislation that would grant vouchers to Pennsylvanians who wish to choose their own families. He says, it's time to let the market work. There's just no good reason why Pennsylvanians who are trapped in failing families through no fault of their own should be denied the better quality of life they would enjoy with a higher performing family. Responding to questions about the availability of high quality families, willingness to accept vouchers, Pakola replied, Pennsylvanians are always eager to offer a helping hand to those who find themselves in dire straits, particularly when there's a buck to be made. So I'm confident that the market will provide. Charles Zogby, Governor Corbett's budget secretary, welcomed Pakola's approach as another example of how the Corbett administration was attempting to return power to ordinary people and to reinforce their narrow self-interests. Mr. Zogby said, that's what Pennsylvanians voted for. I mean, have you seen some of these people's families? Interesting point. And again, it is April 1st, so I'm hoping Mr. Pakola's office doesn't get all up in arms. Anyway, the whole budget thing's going on. They're talking about April 8th being the shutdown. I saw a headline that grabbed my attention. Tea Party supporters cool to budget deal. And there are like six T-twits standing around going, we don't like it. One guy dressed up like Captain America going, you know, shut her down. And I'm going, really? Won't somebody please tell the goofy guy in the costume to sit down and shut up for a second so that we can have a rational discussion about budgets? And I'm great. You know, I've always painted Harry Reid as kind of a wimp, and I still think he's kind of wimpy. But at least on this, he's right, which he basically, you know, he took a swipe at the Tea Party movement today by saying, you know, you got tens of Tea Partiers out at the rally saying, you know, we need to shut down the government. There are tens of them, not hundreds of thousands like we're seeing in Wisconsin. Harry Reid said, unfortunately, today my colleagues in the House seem to be listening to this small but loud minority. And again, these T-twits are a very small, very, very small minority. But, you know, the media has really pushed this out there. They've got talk radio who has just really kind of exploded the idea of this. Not that it's really happening. You know, there aren't 100,000 Tea Partiers marching on state capitals across the country. There's average everyday citizens, working people. And, you know, like I said from the beginning, the Tea Party thing, I got at the beginning. I was angry. I was ticked off. Trade policy sucked. Our tax policy sucks. There's so much that we could be doing to turn things around. And I'm going, yes, finally a movement. Yes, the T-twits are going to lead us. And we're going to, all of us together, going to take our country back. And then they said, it's government's fault. Corporations are the answer. And I stopped and I said, wait a second. I'm not buying that. And now they've bought into this idea. And in fact, I don't even know where the Tea Party stands on it. Some of my Tea Party friends say, we don't need to cut Social Security, but some polls show that the T-Twits want this. And you look at people like Eric Cantor, the guy who said, we're going to have to come to grips with the fact that programs like Social Security can't exist in the America we want. So we're going to have to destroy it, which is what they've been doing for 30 years. You know, understand, when Bush was running around in 2004 going, they're filing cabinets down in the basement, and they're filled with IOUs. They're just paper, just a bunch of IOUs. What he was saying is there are treasury bonds that are down there that are backed by the full faith and credit of the federal government, but that we don't want to have to pay back. And we want to steal from the old people. And I'm saying that Social Security is not in big trouble. We can save it. Because the reality is it doesn't add a dime to our deficit. It does not add one dime to the deficit. Nothing. So we could cut it and it would do nothing to our deficit. I'm against the whole concept of privatizing it. To me, that seems dumb. What we should be talking about is closing the funding gap. And my idea, and I wish someone would pick up on it, because I think it would be a huge stimulus for the working class of this country, and it would save the system. And it would be a huge stimulus for businesses. You cut it down to about 3% each person. The business and the employee pay about 3% instead of the 6.5% we're now paying, except for the 2% for the employees that they took away in that last tax handout after the November election. But you bring that, you lower that rate down, put more money into businesses' pockets, more money into workers' pockets, and you eliminate the cap. Because I got to be honest with you, I think Warren Buffett can afford an extra 3% to kick into the till. Call me strange. I just think it's pretty simple. It's a couple of percent. It's pocket change. I'm sure he spends more than that on hand lotion. But at the end of the day here, we got to have those conversations. And what the right has done is they've been masterful at directing the conversation. All I've been hearing right-wing talkers talking about is, oh, those lefties, those workers, they're talking about taxing the rich, and it's not the rich. Don't go soaking the rich. The rich are the ones who give you jobs. Nobody's ever given me a job. Nobody. Nobody's ever come up to you on the street and said, Rick, I like you so much, here's a job. No. What's happened is I've gone in for an interview. I've sat across the table. I said, this is what I can do for you. I can produce a product for you. I can produce a service for you. I can bring revenue to your company that's going to make you more money than it's costing you to employ me. And every working person in this country, that's how it works. Unless you're the son or daughter or, the son-in-law or daughter-in-law. I'm not being sexist. Unless you get a little nepotism going on there, a little favoritism, which happens occasionally. But at the end of it, only when I produce more than it costs the employer to employ me does he keep me around. And unionized companies understand that as well. This frame that the right loves to use, oh, they're lazy. They're lazy. Then why are they still in business? Because they pay higher wages. So they've evidently got to be more productive than the ones who make less wages. Because if they were equally productive, obviously the higher wages would lose. But what you've got in this country is you've got a bunch of working folks who just aren't getting it. There is wealth in this country. Unimaginable amounts of wealth. It's just you're not entitled to it. You don't have a say in how it's distributed. And I'm telling you, folks, right now I am telling you everything that the right is telling you about the economy is dead wrong. They are preaching from the business perspective. They are preaching from the Coke couch, if you will. Because what they're preaching benefits the Coke brothers, benefits the Scaifes, the Mellons, the very wealthy. And not that uncle who's got a couple million bucks in the bank and got a boat and a camper and all that stuff. He's not wealthy. You know, the best way I've ever heard the difference between a rich guy and a wealthy guy is Shaquille O'Neal is rich. He's got a lot of money. the guy who signs his check is wealthy. That's pretty powerful. Because at the end of the day, even though Shaquille O'Neal makes a boatload of money, he's still a worker. That paycheck goes away at some point. Just like this, what's going on with the NFL. Those workers, some of them make a boatload of money. But at the end of the day, they get hurt, they get fired, they lose their job, that paycheck goes away, their standard of living drops. And drops fast. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk to Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. We're right back after this. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefits Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make history!
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. And now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Delighted.
Big news in Afghanistan.
Yes, a protest by hundreds of people in Afghanistan against the ceremonial burning of the Quran by Terry Jones, this controversial U.S. pastor, left up to 20 people dead as militants overran a UN compound and apparently beheaded foreign staff. We're talking about a protest of up to 2,000 people following prayers today in the northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif, which is considered probably the most one of the most peaceful towns in the country. They overpowered guards, apparently beheaded two people, toppled a guard tower, and torched part of the complex. Apparently, they would like to have taken it out on Americans, couldn't find any, so they went after the UN. Some of the people had been at prayers, apparently heard things, more things about the ceremonial burning of the Quran by Terry Jones, the pastor who had put the Quran on trial a few weeks ago after listening to evidence and arguments from both sides, pronounced it guilty of five crimes against humanity, and then had it set on fire.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm missing that whole book guilty of crimes thing. And it was very nice of you to call him a controversial pastor. I think he's a nut job.
I'm being very polite. I think he's absolutely crazy and extremely dangerous. He is now saying that the U.S. and the U.N. should take immediate action against Muslim nations in retaliation for the deaths, and that the U.N., in fact, should act against Muslim-dominated countries. And
it's nuts. I've got the perfect solution.
Go on.
I will buy the ticket, put him on a plane, send him over there, problem solved.
Well, that's probably the problem solved. That is probably the best way to deal with it, yeah.
We're talking about a shutdown still?
We are talking about a shutdown. They are trying to avoid it because leadership doesn't want it. You've got aides from the House Appropriations Committee and the Senate Appropriations Committee working through the weekend, so they'll be sending out the pizza and Chinese to try and reach a deal, to try and get closer to this magic number. But I would expect you to hear some trash talk from the politicians over the weekend. I mean, they feel that's their job. You don't know how much of that is real and how much of it isn't real, but even if they're able to get to a number, and they might be able to, even with the GOP freshmen, many of them saying, oh, we're not prepared to deal, there's still the question of the riders. There's still the question of the EPA regulations. There's the question of federal funding for Planned Parenthood, and what about funding for the health care bill? And that's really going to be very, very difficult for them to come to some kind of an agreement on.
Well, you had these guys who ran on this exact issue. They're going to destroy everything they can destroy for some bizarre end game that they really, I don't think, grasp how dangerous it is.
I think many people would say that that's a case. Yeah.
What's frustrating to me is we're not hearing anything about raising revenue. It's all about slashing budgets. It's all about cutting services that help people. I'm not seeing anybody talking about changing some of the loopholes that GE might have to pay a little bit of tax. I'm not seeing anything to close some of the loopholes that allow corporations to leave our shores and take tax deductions. I'm not seeing that.
Democrats have started talking about that, actually. They've started talking about a millionaire's tax, going after corporations who do take jobs overseas, things like that. And they immediately got bitten back by Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, who was saying that they're going to hold things up for 40 days if they do this kind of thing. So it's going to be very difficult for them to try and do any kind of revenue enhancer like that. But they're not going to try and do it in this. Democrats, I think, would rather do it in the big budget, which, of course, is going to come out next week. The Republican budget is probably on Tuesday, I believe.
Well, we'll see what happens then. This is April 8th is when the deadline is, right?
That's the deadline. That's when it all comes to a head.
Well, we'll see what happens then. The FAA bill, where's that going?
Well, the FAA bill may go to the Senate, or it may just not go anywhere, really, because Harry Reid may not bring it to the floor. This is a reauthorization of the FAA bill, which should have just been fine, you know, except that there was a little poison pill in it, which makes it very difficult for unions to organize. And there was an effort to get this taken out, and some Republicans crossed lines. And, in fact, some Republicans were saying that there was an awful lot of pressure on them to toe the party line, and they didn't want to at all. They really didn't like this at all, but they felt that they had to. And the Senate really is saying, we're not really going to do anything on this. Several prominent Senate Democrats are saying we're going to remove this amendment from the final bill, and the president's saying he's been advised to veto the legislation if it includes this anti-union language.
You know, I look at this, and it's one of these situations where you look at these T-Twizzlers who are now basically holding everything up, and you go to them, do you believe in the sanctity of the secret ballot, or don't you? Is your hatred of organized labor and your hatred of workers that strong that you're going to defile the secret ballot?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And this idea that if you don't vote in an election, that means that you are voting against
right.
unionization. Well, in that case, that you could say that if you don't vote for a particular politician, that means you're voting against him.
Exactly. If you don't vote for the if you don't come to vote, your vote is automatically counted as a Democratic vote.
Yeah.
Do you think they'd go for it?
I'm not thinking they would somehow.
Not at all. What's going on in Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin, as you know, the law, the union busting, as some would say, law that Scott Walker, the new governor, pushed and got through with the Republicans in a controversial way, had a restraining order put on it. And despite that, the Republicans pushed it through, got it published, said it was law, and the judge ruled three times saying, no, there's a restraining order, you can't do this. Well, there was a testimony today, and she said the restraining order will remain in place for another 2 months, blocking its enactment while she considers whether Republicans broke the state open meetings law in passing it. So she wants additional arguments from the lawyers by May the 23rd.
Yeah, here's the thing. How many times do you get to break the law before they throw you in jail? I got to be honest. If I'm the judge, I'm locking somebody up.
Well, I think if they do it again, she's really going to start putting sanctions on. I think she was really pretty ticked off.
Well, I mean, I would be too if I keep telling. It's like with my children. When they do something wrong and I keep telling them over, eventually they got to go to their room. So I'm saying you got to send the governor to his room. Simple stuff.
I think there are a lot of people in Wisconsin who might be okay with that.
I'll tell you. Other news in Wisconsin? How's the recall going?
Well, the recall actually is starting to go okay for one state senator, because one state senator, they actually have enough ballots. They've got 15,588 signatures for State Senator Dan Kopanky, Republican. So he is about to be subject to a recall election. He's one of the eight state senators Democrats are targeting. They need to flip the upper chamber. They need to defeat three Republicans. He's saying, I love campaigns. I just didn't think I'd do one every year. So he says he's fine with it. Basically what happens, they'll file a petition. There'll be a 31-day review of the signatures, and that could be a nightmare because,
right,
you know that they're all going to be challenged. And then if the extension's not filed, there'll be an election held the sixth Tuesday after the petition's certified.
And I understand they're really close to having enough signatures for the guy who was shacking up with his girlfriend in Madison while his wife was back home in the district. Senator Hopper, I believe his name was.
That's lovely.
And she actually signed the petition against him. You got to love that.
Got to love it.
Hell hath no fury, I guess. What's going on with the Pentagon?
Well, the Pentagon has been training the military in how to implement Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The training required to overturn the ban has been completed for just under 10% of the force so far, according to senior defense officials. And the remainder of the troops should actually get their training by midsummer. So then that paves the way for the Secretary of Defense to certify to Congress that the DOD is ready to implement repeal of the ban. Then there's a 60-day waiting period. And after that, troops should be able to serve openly in the military, probably as early as September.
Training for Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Training to mind your own business. Training to not really care what I'm missing something there. Training?
Yeah, training. There's training in terms of how, particularly for officers, in terms of, rethinking in terms of how to interact if there's a report. And I think for the rank and file, I don't know what the training is. My mind boggles.
Yeah, my grandfather always told me, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. And I kind of follow that. Don't worry about what the other guy's doing. I got enough of the problems of my own. That's why this whole issue, it just seems to be nonsense to me. I don't care what people do in their confines of their four walls as long as it doesn't affect children or me. Simple stuff.
I think most of us would agree with you on that one.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Oh, now the good old union has come in here to thrill. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. You missed any portion of the program. It's right there for your entertainment, your enjoyment, your convenience. Take it with you on the go. Put it in your car. Whatever you got to do. But listen, and feel free to give me some feedback. What your thoughts, comments, questions, ideas are. What would you like to hear? What would you like to see? Just email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. Looking for a job that would pay you, oh, I don't know, $2,500 a day? How about $5,000 a day? How would you like to make $5,000 a day? Well, it's possible, quite possible. If you've got a passport and you're willing to work with radioactive material, the Tokyo Electric Power Company is looking for people to act as jumpers. That's right. A jumper is a guy, and this is a new term to me. He's a guy, a highly paid guy, or girl, not being, just being generic there, highly paid individual who's willing to rush into a radioactive area, perform a task real quick, and then gather the sheep and get the flock out as quick as possible while absorbing dangerous doses of radioactive stuff. How would you like to do that? $5,000 a day sounds great. My question is how many of those days will you survive after that? I look at this and I go, wow, I don't know that I'm that desperate. You know, I've got a friend who flies planes and he used to work for one of the airlines here, made, I guess, a less than stellar living here, working in our airlines. Cause, you know, for years, the airlines in this country have been under attack. So what do? He goes over to Afghanistan. He's flying a plane over there. And I go, you know, it's nice to make that kind of money, but you're in Afghanistan. People are shooting at you. But, you know, I guess it is what you're willing to do to make a living. Amazing stuff. So, you know, you can sign up for the Tokyo Electric Power Company's $5,000 a day jumper job. For me, no thank you. No thank you at all. I want no part of that. No part whatsoever. Because I think, to be honest, I value my life. I value myself. Anyway, they're saying up to 20 UN workers were killed on Friday afternoon. I guess it's morning here or there, when protesters overran a compound and beheaded two foreigners. But up to 20 workers were killed at the UN. 10 foreign UN workers were killed in the attack at the headquarters of the northern Afghan city by demonstrators protesting the burning of the Quran by some nitwit U.S. pastor. And again, you know, I look at this and I go, you know, maybe we should send him over there. You know, we talked about this when it happened, that they held some bizarre kangaroo court. And, you know, I look at this and I'm going, really, you held a trial in the church? You had all the congregation in their Sunday best, you know, holding a trial. And then you set the book on fire. You found it guilty and you set it on fire. And somehow that is religion. That's Christianity. You know, I had a conversation with my chief engineer over here about religion and Christianity, and I go, you know, to be honest, the tenets that the right are pushing out are not the Christianity that I understand. I don't understand the whole Muslim thing. I just don't. But you know, I always thought that we were maybe a little bit better. But I guess the way I view Christianity, the way the radical right views it, are two very different visions. I come from an idea of social justice, peace. I think Jesus was a pacifist, if anything. Not even a nonviolent person, just a pacifist. Because if I remember right, there's only one instance where Jesus gets angry in the Bible and is actually physical. That's when he flipped over the tables in the church. Now, I'm no scholar, and you can email me and tell me if I'm wrong, rick@therickssmithshow.com. But at the end of this, I don't remember him smacking people or beating people up. I don't remember the whole eye for an eye thing in his world. So very, very different views. Speaking of different views, there's a Montana state legislator. His name is Alan Hale. Alan runs a bar in Basin, Montana. So, you know, he's a bar owner, you know, and they sell alcohol and they do a whole bunch of things. They were debating a bill on how to make sure that minors don't get access to alcohol. They were debating this bill that would count old DUI offenses against the defendant in sentencing and require new training for vendors who sell alcohol. So the bar owner, you know, is going to have to know when someone's drunk and maybe not, you know, sell them. Kind of stuff we've done 20 years ago. Well, Montana, they're kind of getting around to talking about it now. So this bar owner, this Alan Hale, he says, these DUI laws are not doing our small businesses in our state any good at all. They're destroying them. They're destroying in a way of life. And that's been Montana for years. And I looked at this and I go, really? Did he honestly say that? And I looked it up and, yeah, duh, he did. This idea that drinking and driving in Montana must be a birthright. But this is who's in charge of the Republican Party. And that's not even an April Fool's joke. What else is not an April Fool's joke? Representative Tom Marino in this area. He's in our Scranton area up that way. He's on the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Africa. And it's kind of funny. You know, he says, you know, well, we're going into Libya. We might as well go into Africa next. Of course, everyone knows that Libya is, of course, in Africa. I think even Sarah Palin knew that. But anyway, today he was back in his district, and I guess he was participating in a U.S. Homeland Security role in Mexico war on drugs cartel kind of a hearing. He was participating in this hearing, and he decided to ditch the hearing and go talk to Tea Party protesters instead. During the rally, Renetta Fenwick, Marino's director of communications, came out to hear what the Tea Party people wanted. She told them that the congressman would appreciate knowing, you know, that he had their support and he would pass along their comments and all that stuff. Ms. Fenwick then, after the rally, said she was able to get Mr. Marino on the phone from Washington to speak to those people who were in his Tuncanic office. And she said, quote, "We pulled him out of a Homeland Security meeting to do it." So, you know, you look at the fact that, A, he doesn't know, he's on the subcommittee on Africa, doesn't know that Libya's in Africa, and now he's pulled out of Homeland Security meetings to talk to a handful of T-twits. I don't know that this guy really, I don't think he really gets it. Maybe he should recuse himself from the committees, all of them, and devote more time to his Tea Party rallying. That would be a good thing for him. Anyway... the Tea Party in Congress doesn't just hate the EPA that protects against industry destroying our country. They don't seem to enjoy any of the regulations on greenhouse gas pollution, mercury, coal ash, mountaintop removal. They're in favor of it all. Let's have it all. Do away with the EPA. Do away with all that, say our T-twit friends. And I don't know if you've been hearing that ad that's been on the radio here lately from the coal people. Don't let them use a 40-year-old rule. Which, you know, I stop and I think about. And, you know, I remember growing up in Cleveland when the steel mills were really pumping out a bunch of pollution. When the Clean Air Act came in, didn't realize it as a kid, but my asthma got an awful lot better. And now that I look back on it, because I had, when I was a kid, I had horrible asthma. In fact, ended up in the hospital for 2 weeks. Because my lungs had almost completely filled up with mucus and phlegm and stuff and nastiness. In fact, I still remember to this day. I think I was 11 years old. They took blood from the artery every other day. So they come in with this long needle and they jab it into your arm and into the middle of your arm, not to that little vein that's on top, all the way in the middle down to the artery. And they suck out some blood to check the blood gas and check how much oxygen's going in there so you're not completely brain dead, which some say to me that, you know, maybe that time did kill a bunch of brain cells, and partially probably true, along with my drinking when I was playing in the band. But that set aside, I still remember that. But as the years went by and the air cleared up, you know what happened? My asthma went away, and I was able to breathe. And what a wonderful thing clean air is, and how wonderful clean water is. You know, also when I was a kid, you couldn't go swimming in Lake Erie because it was the fish were floating sideways with these huge tumors on them. Why? Because we had polluted the water so badly. You couldn't go down to Edgewater Park down there in Cleveland, jump into the water. You'd come out covered in who knows what. Which is why I think the Clean Water and Clean Air Act was the best thing that ever happened. But you got these T-twits who are, yeah, we don't want no EPA. We don't want them regulating what we can put into the streams and the lakes and the rivers. Those EPA people, they're just fascists. They're just communists. Socialists. Actually, somebody called me a communist, socialist, fascist once. And I told him, I said, if you really understood what you just said, you'd be afraid of yourself. And to be honest, I was. Labor Department reports that the U.S. economy added 216,000 jobs last month. Good sign. Unemployment at a year low of 8.8%. Coming up to the weekend, I'm going to be spending the weekend here at the AFSCME Counts 13 convention, saying hello to some old friends, meeting some new friends. For those of you who are members of AFSCME, I say you participate, get involved. Great group there. April 4th, Monday, 11:30 in the a.m. Shuffle on down 3rd Street, up the steps, into the Capitol. Right there in the rotunda, they're going to have the We Are One rally. We're going to be there. We're hoping that you'll come out and say hello, participate. That's your house. Step inside and have your voice heard. I hope you have a great weekend. I want to wish my son Alex a happy 5th birthday tomorrow. Can't believe my boy's 5. We'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's coming, time flows.
love beneath the lunar sway. Imperial with a serious and amorous array. Democracy is coming to the USP.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.